Crazy Wisdom. The beginning is also the middle. In the 4th century BC in China, the Taoist Chuang Tzu said, "Where can I find a man who has forgotten words? I would like to have a word with him." Chuang Tzu speaks with crazy wisdom. Crazy wisdom is the wisdom of the saint, the Zen master, the poet, the mad scientist, and the fool. Crazy wisdom sees that we live in a world of many illusions, and that the emperor has no clothes, and that much of human belief and behavior is ritualized nonsense. Crazy wisdom understands antimatter and old Sufi poetry, loves paradox and puns and pie fights and laughing at politicians. Crazy wisdom flips the world upside down and backward until everything becomes perfectly clear. From the Taoists to the Dadaists, from the Book of Ecclesiastes to Mark Twain's Letters to the Earth, in the parables of Chuang Tzu and the Baal Shem Tov, out of the cyclonic whirl of Rumi's dervish poetry and the profound nonsense of Samuel Beckett's confused characters, lurking beneath the unruly hair of Albert Einstein and between the bushy eyebrows of Groucho Marx, inside the howly voice of Allen Ginsberg and from behind the rags of Lily Tomlin's bag lady, whatever tone it speaks in, whatever disguise it wears, crazy wisdom arises again and again to expose us to ourselves and to remind us of the strange, impossible nature of our enterprise here on earth, life. A Zen Buddhist saying sums it up this way: if you understand, things are just as they are. If you do not understand, things are just as they are. A little crazy wisdom must have been around in prehistoric times. No doubt some contrary ancient sage was there to tell cave people that capturing fire would create as many problems as it would solve. Crazy wisdom must be at least as old as conventional wisdom. True and false are constant companions. The ideas and attitudes that we are calling crazy wisdom come from many sources. The most complete expressions of a crazy wisdom point of view can be found in Taoism, Zen and Tibetan Buddhism, and Sufism. But crazy wisdom also finds expression in the work of certain artists, writers, and philosophers, both Eastern and Western. Crazy wisdom appears as well in folklore and mythology, where archetypal figures such as the clown, the trickster, the jester, and the fool act out the human comedy of errors. Throughout history, these crazy wisdom characters appear in various disguises to point out the errors and the comedy. For example, if crazy wisdom knows anything, it is that we don't know. We don't know who we are, why we are, where we are, or what this life and universe are about. Even with the brave new knowledge of the 20th century, we still do not know the answer to these perennial questions, and perhaps we never will. We may be able to describe the world as we see it, give names to things, and even tentatively understand how some processes work, but we don't have a clue as to why things are the way they are, or why they are at all. As Joseph Campbell says, "What's fire? You can tell me about oxidation, but that doesn't tell me a thing." We can explain how the respiratory system functions, but who can speak of the mystery of breath? Even if we think we understand the evolution of the human species, we still don't know where it's going next or why it developed in the first place. Although many spiritual schools claim to lead to self-knowledge, it seems we can never know ourselves completely. It's impossible to see the exact nature of a box when you are inside of it. We may admit that we can't know the ultimate meaning of life, yet we still assume we can understand the laws of nature and how the universe works. However, looking back through history at our knowledge of the world, we find that the facts change with every century and every civilization. By now, it should be evident that what we know or think we know is perceived through a dense series of veils. Veils of culture, language, historical moment, and biological development. We and the world around us are always hidden from ourselves by ourselves. Crazy wisdom also understands that the many conflicting answers to the unanswerable questions are what get humanity into its deepest troubles. Whether over God, government, or gross national product, all wars are holy wars fought by people who think they alone know the truth. Another principle of crazy wisdom is that humans don't know how to think. Or maybe we just think too much. In either case, what passes for reason often turns out to be unreasonable in the end. Our so-called rational mind is deeply conditioned, psychologically and culturally, and what is labeled reasoning is often just the mind making excuses for emotional needs and reactive behavior. Reason has become our ideology, but we may not yet be able to tell it apart from wishful thinking. It may also be that the intellect is overvalued and even overdeveloped. It may be that we think so much we can't think, and know so much we don't know anything. As Arthur Koestler writes, the evolution of the brain not only overshot the needs of prehistoric man, it is the only example of evolution providing a species with an organ which it does not know how to use. Reason may be humanity's greatest boon, but it is also our most bitter curse, perhaps even our fatal flaw. What reason has gained for us by giving us some degree of mastery over our world, it has equally taken away by separating us from that world. Furthermore, the act of thinking can be tiresome and is often painful. Sometimes it feels we are locked into the prison of our mind and given a life sentence. Our punishment is to suffer under a life of sentences. The train of thought runs over our lives. As the French philosopher Valéry writes, man's great misfortune is that he has no organ, no kind of eyelid or break to mask or block a thought, or all thoughts, when he wants to. Of course, reason and the intellect are important tools for survival, as well as natural wonders that give us the capacity to create great flying machines and figures of speech. However, even the greatest scientists say that it is not the rational mind that comes up with the most significant discoveries. Something else is taking place. When the apple hit Isaac Newton on the head, it must have knocked all the knowledge out. Then gravity could finally get in. That gravity, however, did not bring Newton or the Western world back down to Earth. As Carl Jung writes, if you are depressed, you are too high up in your mind. And maybe we think too much of ourselves. Crazy Wisdom does not believe that humans are necessarily the ultimate reason for the universe existing. Because of unyielding vanity, or perhaps a genetically encoded belief, we still think and behave as though the whole show was created for our sake, and that our own history is somehow the major concern of the cosmos. Such a belief might be reasonable if we still believed that the sun goes around the earth. We should know better by now. As science pushes back the boundaries of space and time, it also puts us in our place, shrinking our significance relative to the uncountable solar systems and the light years of time. The most radical of Crazy Wisdom does not view our personal human history or even the evolution of the species as movement toward a higher state. What makes us believe that things are advancing? Who is to say that we are better off now than we ever were? For that matter, who is to say that we are better off now than before we were at all? The poet Charles Baudelaire says, belief in progress is a doctrine of idlers and Belgians. Looking at the human species in the 20th century, we can only guess that evolution is not yet finished. If we are the end product, then we must assume that the cosmic design is, at best, somewhat flawed. Furthermore, if we don't mutate our way into some sleek new species, we will probably be going the way of the dinosaurs. Either way, Crazy Wisdom usually tries to remove some of the heavy melodrama and sentimentality from the human story. As Friedrich Nietzsche writes, for the present, the comedy of human existence has not yet become conscious of itself. For the present, we still live in the age of tragedy, the age of moralities and religions. Crazy Wisdom is about a different way of knowing. As the Indian poet Kabir says, the knowledge beyond knowledge is my knowledge. Some call this other way of knowing intuition or vision. Artists say they are touched by the muses, while some spiritual masters refer to direct seeing or revelation. Some modern seekers say Crazy Wisdom comes to us through a different part of the brain, perhaps the mysterious right hemisphere. Whatever the pathway or process might be, in order to hear Crazy Wisdom, we need to somehow shut off or turn down the grinding noise of the rational analytic gears. Crazy Wisdom requires that we get at least a little bit out of our minds. This can be done through prayer, meditation, nature, art, poetry, stories, and song. As the author Thomas Pynchon says, "You may never get to touch the master, but you can tickle his creatures." The Crazy Wisdom Archetypes. The clown, the jester, the trickster, and the fool are the four crazy wisdom archetypes. They have devised some brilliant disguises, so it may appear at times they have nothing at all to do with wisdom. Some of them put on masks in order to unmask us. Others remove all masks. Some mimic and mime to show us who we are. These four archetypal characters share an uncanny ability to escape the troubles they inevitably get themselves into. The clown gets bonked and bopped, and the trickster is dismembered and blown apart. The jester may have his head cut off by the king or be hit by rotten fruit thrown from the audience, and the great fool is about to fall off a cliff or be martyred by an angry mob. But just when it seems that all is lost, they rise again, recovered and whole, even from death. The dismembered coyote reassembles. Jesus Christ rises into everlasting life. The crazy wisdom characters seem to be immortal. And although these four are at times banished from the institutions of church and state, they can often be found hanging out with the common folk. Over time, they have made their way into the stories, legends, and songs of the people. First, the clown. As archetypal psychologist James Hillman writes, "The comic spirit masquerades in all things we say and do. We are each a clown and do not need to put on a white face." The clown is the most human of the crazy wisdom archetypes. The clown's too big mouth is grotesquely grinning or super sad, mocking our mortal moods. We laugh because the clown is one of us, pathetic and lovable, trying hard but always flailing and failing. The clown shows us our awkward human condition and encourages us to laugh. We are all clowns, always getting fouled up, mixed up, thwarted by circumstance. We climb the ladder only to find it is leaning against the wrong wall. We search for hats that are already on our heads. We plan our days only to find that the days have other plans. The clown points out our vulnerability. Although he is eager and hopeful, we know he will not succeed. His great triumph is the sheepish grin or shrug he displays after his failures. "Oh, well," he seems to say, "that's the way it goes." The clown quickly forgets the past and moves on to the next disaster. The clown's world in which all of us live is not a practical joke. It is an impractical joke. It is the world of Laurel and Hardy moving a piano or of Elmer Fudd trying to get rid of the wabbit. In this clown's world, appliances don't work right. We try to clean things up, but in the process make them dirty again. Just having a body sometimes seems an absurd condition. We run in circles wearing shoes that don't fit right, so we get nowhere and get blisters on the way. The clown is living proof of the second law of thermodynamics. In this world, all things tend toward chaos and dissolution. Some even say the clown's white face is the mask of death, grinning out from within us at our feeble attempts to create order and meaning out of life's three-ring circus. In the end, says the white face, we are always the butt of the joke. The clown is also the everyman figure, personified by Charlie Chaplin, caught in the machinery of modern times or lured to the gold rush with the rest of the crowd. He is the unfortunate immigrant, the ordinary sad sack guy buffeted about by the forces of history, yet surviving somehow, sometimes managing a foolish grin and occasionally even clicking up his worn-out heels as he walks off into the sunset. The clown is the lighter side of the dark forces, chaos transformed and made benign, the subconscious as silly. The clown is the most lovable of all the crazy wisdom archetypes. The second crazy wisdom archetype is the jester. Sigmund Freud writes, "No matter how much restriction civilization imposes on the individual, he nevertheless finds some way to circumvent it. Wit is the best safety valve modern man has evolved. The more civilization, the more repression, the more need there is for wit." Jesters are the wits and the critics. They expose the current establishment and make light of the contemporary social scene. While the clown reveals the timeless foibles of humanity, the jester takes on the social and political behaviors specific to the current age. The jester has appeared in many guises, as playwright and pamphleteer, roaming minstrel and balladeer, actor in the Commedia dell'arte, master of ceremonies at a cabaret or vaudeville show, as cartoonist, satirist, parody writer, and as the contemporary stand-up comedian. As the great jester Lenny Bruce once said, "People should be taught what is, not what should be. All of my humor is based on despair. If the whole world were tranquil, without disease and violence, I'd be standing in the bread line." Right in back of J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI. Unlike the very human clown, the jester is barely human, a character whose teeth and tongue are equally sharp. He gets away with dangerous revelations by making them funny. The jester usually works with words. While the clown mimes, the jester mimics. It has been said that the pen is mightier than the sword. The jester slices the S off sword and thrusts with the word. The jester jousts with a sharp tongue, hurling barbs, needles, jabs, sticking it to them, laying them low, killing them. The jester takes the wind out of politicians' sails, deflates inflated rhetoric, punctures hypocrisy and hypocrisy, bureaucracy and boreaucracy, until they are shown to be nothing but hot air, the laughable breeze made by the human species fawning over itself and flapping its jaws. The court jester is the king's own hired fool, and often his best advisor. While others are afraid to tell the king the truth, the court jester points out the political realities. But he had better be funny because his head is at stake. The jester Jonathan Swift shocked his nation during the Irish famine of the early 1700s by suggesting, in a modest proposal, "I have been assured by a very knowing American of my acquaintance in London that a young, healthy child, well-nursed, is, at a year old, a most delicious, nourishing, and wholesome food, whether stewed, roasted, baked, or boiled, and I make no doubt that it will equally serve in a fricassee or a rag-out." Mark Twain was the consummate jester artist. His most irreverent writing, collected in Letters from the Earth, was not published until the 1940s, nearly 30 years after Twain's death. If sections of this book had been released in his lifetime, Twain might well have been lynched. Here's Twain taking off on Jehovah himself. "He says, naively, outspokenly, and without suggestion of embarrassment, 'I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God.' You see, it's only another way of saying, 'I, the Lord thy God, am a small God and fretful about small things.' He simply could not bear the thought of any other god getting some of the Sunday compliments of this comical little human race." Twain also wonders why people would love a god who doles out such a life as this. He writes, "The Christian begins with this straight proposition: God is all-knowing and all-powerful. Then, having thus made the Creator responsible for all pains and diseases and miseries which he could have prevented, the gifted Christian blandly calls him our Father." Instead of relying on the pun or the pen, some jesters venture into the streets to make their point, displaying crazy wisdom through defiant acts of political theater. Diogenes, the cynic, an infamous figure in ancient Greece, walked the streets of Athens with a lantern at night, telling people he was looking for an honest man. Diogenes, who despised worldly possessions and lived in a bathtub, gained great respect as a philosopher. Legend has it that he once masturbated on the steps of the Parthenon, requesting those who only masturbated in the privacy of their homes to join him in a public display of naked honesty. The 20th century has demanded outrageous acts of defiance from its jesters, and they have risen to the test. In the late 1960s, the American counterculture staged many acts of protest through guerrilla theater. The Yippies, members of the Youth International Party, threw money from the balcony of the New York Stock Exchange onto the trading floor below. And to protest the Vietnam War, the same group gathered thousands of people to surround the Pentagon and then chanted Om in unison in an attempt to levitate the massive building. They claimed success. The jesters are often naysayers, saying no to obvious lies, absurdities, and injustices. As the late jester Abby Hoffman said, "All isms should be wasms." The third crazy wisdom archetype, the trickster. Iktomi, the Ogallala trickster, says, "Since everybody laughs at me, I will laugh at them." The tricksters are the rascals of myth and folklore. Sometimes they appear as the bumbling creators of the world, the source of all our troubles. At other times, they seem to be nothing more than ribald sex fiends. Whichever role they play, the tricksters do not abide by ordinary codes of behavior. They emerge from a time before good and evil, and their crazy wisdom is to act out our uncivilized primal nature. When the trickster coyote is given the role of creator, he always makes a mess of things. In the beginning, it is told, Coyote had a sack full of stars that he was supposed to place in the sky. He was doing a good job at first, putting the stars in neat rows, but soon he got bored and restless, and finally he just flung the remaining stars up where they are now, haphazard in the sky. This kind of thing happened with many of Coyote's jobs as creator. And how might the world have looked if Coyote had taken more care? After carelessly creating the universe, the trickster becomes wild nature in the flesh, arriving in villages to sniff around for some action. When the trickster coyote visits the Indian tribes of North and Central America, he has absolutely no manners. It is said that he laughs through his anus, and by most accounts, he is a shameless sex fiend called Cunt-Craving Coyote by the Hopi, and in one story, even having sex with his own daughter. Who exactly is this scroungy dog cat? To find out, you must try to locate Coyote sometime. He seems to have survived the modern world better than some other tricksters, and he can still be seen around campfires and at powwows, sneaking into zendos, or hanging around coffee houses in red light districts. In a recent book, Coyote's Journal, a group of contemporary writers tell things about Coyote's past that were not known before. For example, poet Lowell Jagger writes an answer to the age-old question, why dogs smell each other's butts. When he asked, the dogs refused him. You are unclean, they told Coyote. You are not a dog. So the dogs undressed for their sweat bath and entered the sweat lodge without him. Coyote envied the glossy fur coats the dogs had hung outside the lodge. He thought of stealing them, but he decided not to. Instead, he threw the long coats in a great pile and wiped his muddy feet across them. Then he set fire to the sweat lodge roof and said in a loud voice, "Oh, what will the dogs do now? Coyote has taken their fur!" From behind a rock, Coyote sat laughing as the naked dogs rushed into the cold out of doors, grabbing for a coat, afraid there might be too few to cover everyone. Years later, as the story goes, with every dog zipped in someone else's fur, dogs smell each other's butts looking for their own. Meanwhile, Coyote is still grinning off in the hills somewhere, rolling in red dirt, thinking how crude to be a dog, how much more clean, how much more fun to be Coyote. Coyote is most often seen, depicted with his head back, muzzle facing upward, howling at the moon. The secret of his crazy wisdom can be understood by listening closely to his cry. In it one can hear a bittersweet mixture of both longing and laughter, mocking and moaning. Even though he loves to steal the stage, Coyote is just one of the animal forms that the trickster takes. In North and Central Native American tribes, he also appears as raven, crow, or hare, in Europe as Reynard the Fox, in Africa as the spider Anansi, and in the American South as Br'er Rabbit. Aspects of the trickster also appear in the deities and mythical characters of many cultures. The Hindu Lord Krishna is part trickster and loves to play jokes on mortals, especially the young girls, the milkmaids, whom he dazzles with his divine radiance and magic powers. If you were a god, wouldn't you? Another trickster is the Greek god Hermes, who often delivers messages that people would rather not receive. The tricksters seem to be making a comeback these days. The crazy wisdom of these mythological rascals refuses to be paved over. Where the brush begins to thicken just outside the boundaries of our civilized encampment, the trickster howls at night to remind us of the chaos that lives all around. The fourth archetype, the fool. As Shakespeare wrote, "Lord, what fools these mortals be." But William Blake answers him by saying, if the fool would persist in his folly, he would become wise. Because there are actually two types of fool, the foolish fool and the great fool. The foolish fool is inept and silly. a sort of clown of the mind. But the great fool is wise beyond ordinary understanding. The foolish fool is the one we see every day when we look into the mirror or walk down the street. The great fool is the rarest of beings. Innocence is the trademark of both fools. The innocence of the foolish fool makes him clumsy and unsophisticated as he tries to live according to social convention. But the great fool does not try to fit in. He lives by his own rules. The foolish fool and his money are soon parted, but the great fool gives his money away. The foolish fool always gets lost, while the great fool is at home everywhere. The great fool has different values from the rest of us, different visions of reality. The great fool shows his face as the first card in the tarot deck. He is the master of ceremonies, smiling and welcoming us to the show, the grand illusion, the parade of archetypal characters to follow. The fool announces that what we are about to see is only a melodrama, and that we should not take these masks or matters too seriously. Our personalities are just put-ons, personae, roles we are given to play. We just read the lines and flesh out scenes. There's really not much we can do about the plot. Our destiny is, after all, written in the cards. In the tarot, the fool is portrayed wandering in the sunshine with his knapsack and little dog, seemingly without a care in the world and with no particular place to go. And he is about to step off the edge of a cliff. Perhaps the fool knows he will go over the cliff, but continues to smile because he also knows he will never hit bottom. The fool understands that he, the cliff, and the bottom are all illusions. The fool is the only unnumbered card in the tarot deck. He represents the nothingness from which the universe emerged. As the zero, the fool himself has no value. He is outside the boundaries of number or sequence, outside of all categories, beyond good and evil. With the fool, anything can happen, and all things, even death, are equally worthy of his perpetual smile. Finally, as a testament to his power, the fool is one of the few characters from the tarot deck to make it into our modern playing cards. He becomes the Joker, always wild. Like the fool, the Joker is without number or trump. He has no specific value, and therefore is of the greatest value. The Joker is mightier than the kings and higher than the aces. The fool can be found playing the central role in folk stories from around the world, acting out the extremes of either wisdom or folly. One of the most famous of fools is Mullah Nasruddin, who is especially popular in the Arabic world. The Muslim mystics use stories about Nasruddin as spiritual lessons, giving him the role of either village idiot or eccentric sage. In the following story, we find Nasruddin teaching his own brand of crazy wisdom to the people. Nasruddin was asked to speak to the congregation at the mosque, so he went up to the front and asked, "Oh, people, do you know what I have come to tell you?" The crowd answered, "No." Nasruddin then said, "If you don't know what I have come to tell you, then you are too ignorant to understand what I was going to say." And he left the mosque. But the people knew he had great wisdom, so they invited him back the next week. This time when Nasruddin asked the congregation if they knew what he was going to tell them, the crowd answered, "Yes." "Fine," said Nasruddin, "then I don't need to waste your time." And once again he left the mosque. But once again the people invited him back, thinking the next time they could convince him to talk. When he arrived in the following week, Nasruddin again asked the congregation if they knew what he was going to tell them. This time half of the people answered back yes, and half of them answered back no. "Fine," said Nasruddin, "then those who know should tell those who don't, and I will be on my way." A Hasidic story reveals one rabbi's wise and crazy teaching methods. One day, the rabbi was visited by a poor man who complained that he had to live in a tiny one-room house with his wife, six children, and mother-in-law. It was so crowded he couldn't stand it any longer. He was losing his mind. "Do you have any animals?" the rabbi asked. "Yes, chickens and a goat," the man replied. "Good," said the rabbi. "Bring the goat into the house to live with you." The poor man objected, but finally agreed to follow the rabbi's suggestion. A week later, the man came back to the rabbi, even more exasperated, saying, "Rabbi, I brought the goat into my house, and now it is worse than before. I can't stand it. What should I do now?" The rabbi said, "Go home, and also bring the chickens into the house to live with you." The man objected again, but finally did as he was told. A week later, he came back to the rabbi, dazed and crying, It is impossible now in my house, Rabbi. Help me! Help me!" Then the rabbi said, "Go home and take out the goat and the chickens." The man did as he was told, and a few days later came back to the rabbi, smiling and grateful, saying, "Rabbi, my house is now so spacious and peaceful. You certainly are the wisest man who ever lived." In folk stories, we learn much about the ways of fools and their extremes of wisdom and folly. However, the great fool is central in the saga of crazy wisdom, so it is important to meet this archetype in a historical context also. We will be surprised to discover that many of us pray to some form of the great fool almost daily. They are the holy fools. As the Sufi Junayd of Baghdad said, "None attains to the degree of truth until 1,000 honest people have testified that he is a heretic." The holy fools arise from the spiritual subcultures, the esoteric and mystical underground of the world's great religious traditions. They know a different reality than the rest of us and live every moment in accordance with their understanding, no matter what the cost. They are divine madmen. Among the better known are Lao Tzu, Buddha, and Christ, all challengers of conventional truth, and all masters. Although today it may seem inappropriate to label these holy men fools, they were probably called that in their own time. Certainly more people thought them foolish than wise. Lao Tzu reputedly turned down good jobs with the king in order to live a secluded life in the mountains. In court circles, they probably laughed when Lao Tzu's name or ideas were mentioned. Gautama the Buddha was no doubt viewed as just one of the more popular cult leaders of his time. He set up communal dwellings in the forest where he taught his followers to reject ordinary worldly pursuits and to replace them with an odd-sounding doctrine called the Middle Path. If the Buddha were alive and teaching today, many parents would probably arrange to have their children kidnapped from his community and deprogrammed. Jesus ministered to the poor and dared to challenge the authority of church and state, but the respectable people of his time probably saw him as a scruffy, troublesome street person. Not only was Jesus labeled a fool, he sometimes accepted the role and deliberately played the fool as part of his radical protests. Whirling out of Islam came the Sufi masters, mad with their dancing and chanting. They offered people a direct and joyous means of praising Allah. Similarly, the Hasidic rabbis led their people in song and dance in praise of the Lord. The Baal Shem Tov declared that the peasant who could only whistle the prayers was as delightful to God as the learned scholar who could recite the Talmud by memory. A similar message comes through the Black Southern Baptist gospel tradition and the hypnotic, ecstatic singing of Krishna devotees. "If I can't dance, I don't want to be in your religion." The holy fools are religious revolutionaries. Some even write their own scriptures, or their lives become scripture. Only after their death comes the charlatans, and then the churches. Chances are, if these great crazy wisdom masters came back today, they would refuse to join the churches that have been built in their name. Mohandas Gandhi was a great holy fool and was recently among us. With only a spinning wheel and a copy of the Hindu Song of God, the Mahatma challenged the British Empire and the whole of Western civilization. According to Gandhi, religion and politics are inseparable, and both should be lived according to the primary principle of nonviolence. Gandhi's nonviolence is a complete way of life and forms the cornerstone for his idea of village socialism. Gandhi wrote, "Centralization as a system is inconsistent with a nonviolent structure of society. By the nonviolent method, we seek not to destroy the capitalist, but we do seek to destroy capitalism." Gandhi understood there would be violence as long as there were extremes of rich and poor in the world. When he was in Europe, he saw how Western capitalism and urban life fostered greed and disharmony. Therefore, while most of the developing world rushed towards Western-style industrialization, Gandhi urged India to develop small cottage industries and foster cooperative village life. He believed that a village society could save India from the evils of the 20th century. In Gandhi's vision, only by living in small-scale communities could people find social harmony, individual happiness, and spiritual fulfillment. Like so many of the holy fools before him, Gandhi dedicated his life to helping the poor, and he lived as one of them. When he died, his only possessions were his spinning wheel, a figurine of the See No Evil, Hear No Evil, Speak No Evil monkeys, his spectacles and walking staff, and a few pieces of homespun clothing. Once Gandhi visited England's King George wearing only a loincloth and sandals. When questioned about the propriety of his attire, Gandhi replied, "The king was wearing enough for both of us." On another occasion, when Gandhi was asked what he thought of Western civilization, he answered, "I think it would be a good idea." Gandhi was an exemplary modern holy fool, challenging the dominant behavior of the 20th century, the pursuit of wealth and practice of warfare. He came to his own definition of God, declaring that truth is God, and not the other way around, as commonly stated. Gandhi has been compared to both Jesus and Buddha, and although he became a powerful influence throughout the world, his methods were often ridiculed, and his message was ultimately ignored. Like the holy fools before him, Gandhi tried to move the world in another direction, and although by our standards it appears that he failed, his legacy is yet to be determined. As Gandhi himself said, "Satisfaction lies in the effort, not in the attainment. Full effort is full victory." As we have seen, the holy fools have varying degrees of success with their truth. Some of them found the right symbols and metaphors for their time, and some created new myths out of their own lives, and were posthumously accorded the status of deity. Through their rebellious visions and deeds, these holy fools became the symbolic representation of the meaning of it all. Now we will proceed to look at crazy wisdom throughout history and follow its emergence in both Eastern and Western cultures. We will begin in the Orient, since that is where crazy wisdom made its first recorded appearances and gave some of its most brilliant performances. The most complete expression of a crazy wisdom point of view is contained in Taoism and Zen Buddhism. Neither is exactly a philosophy or religion. The early masters of Taoism and Zen Buddhism did not promote a god or even much of a metaphysical system. These holy fools saw life not as a puzzle to be solved, but as a mystery to be lived. Instead of the typical Western concerns with intellectual certainty or individual salvation, Taoist and Zen Buddhist masters saw their state of grace as one of just being, living without ideology, analysis, or a higher meaning. To learn this state, they made nature their teacher. The Taoists and Zen Buddhists sought to embed themselves from moment to moment in the web of life. In their meditations, the Eastern sages developed a level of understanding that would not emerge in the West until nearly 2,000 years later. They recognized that the mind is thoroughly conditioned and that each individual is an unstable flow of thoughts, emotions, and changing identities. They saw that the idea of a free agent called the self is largely a fiction. Furthermore, long before the Western world got a glimpse of just how big the universe is, the Eastern sages seem to have grasped intuitively the enormous reaches of space and time. They believed that the vastness of the universe is beyond human comprehension, and that within this context, the individual does not have much freedom or significance. Since each person is subject to the overriding forces of biological and cosmic evolution, no one is able to control or even understand their destiny. The crazy wisdom of Taoists and Zen masters may sound especially crazy to Westerners, and often not so wise. It does not justify existence. It is not about reason or faith. You don't pray to anything, or even do much of anything. Sometimes you hardly move. Both truth and salvation are a matter of acceptance, of just being. How now, great Tao? As Chuang Tzu says, "Someday there will be a great awakening when we know that this is all a great dream, yet the stupid believe they are awake, busily and brightly assuming they understand things, calling this man ruler, that one herdsman. How dense! Confucius and you are both dreaming, and when I say you are dreaming, I am dreaming too." Words like these will be labeled the supreme swindle, yet after 10,000 generations a great sage may appear who will know their meaning. Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu are the quintessential crazy wisdom masters and the founding fathers of Taoism, a radical Eastern existential philosophy that emerged in the 6th and 5th century B.C. in China. Lao Tzu is the reputed author of the Tao Te Ching, the fundamental Taoist text. He is the more serious of the two, the philosopher of paradox and vast perspectives. Chuang Tzu is much lighter, a storyteller who uses parable and humor to mock ordinary human understanding. Chuang Tzu turns everything upside down to show us the way. He writes, "Who can look on non-being as his head, on life as his back, and on death as his rump? Who knows that life and death, existence and annihilation are all a single body? I will be his friend." Taoism's basic principle is that all things are one. But Master Lao and Master Chuang draw the most extreme conclusions from this idea. For them, the unity of all things means that no distinction can be made between life and death, right and wrong, holy and profane, or any other this and that. The Taoist holy fools stand right in the middle of the paradox, where all dualities converge. As Chuang Tzu says, "Right is not right, so is not so. If right were really right, it would differ so clearly from not right that there would be no need for argument. If so were really so, it would differ so clearly from not so that there would be no need for argument. Forget the years, forget distinctions, leap into the boundless and make it your home." The Taoist holy fools shed doubt on all our plans and ambitions. For example, Lao Tzu baldly states, "Exterminate learning and there will no longer be any worries." Now, how would philosophers and scholars in the West react to this idea? Go ahead, try to impart that message to the U.S. Secretary of Education, for example. How would he react? Lao Tzu says, "When a foolish man hears of the Tao, he laughs out loud. If he didn't laugh, it wouldn't be the Tao." Lao Tzu knows that his crazy wisdom sounds like nonsense to most people. After all, he recommends that we give up our reasonable approach to life, give up any idea we might have of a purposeful existence, give up our pursuit of wealth or fame or happiness. He and Chuang Tzu suggest we are going about this business of living the wrong way. The Taoists propose nothing less than total freedom, which can only be achieved by non-doing. It sounds contradictory, especially to rational Western humanists, that we might gain control by giving up control. But Chuang Tzu claims there is no alternative. We continually forget that we are dwarfed by the landscape of galaxies, swept up in immense natural forces, nothing but dust in the great winds of chance and change. To Taoists, freedom is understanding we are not in control and never will be. The only struggle is to stop struggling. Chuang Tzu writes, "There was a man who was so displeased by the sight of his own shadow and so displeased with his own footsteps that he determined to get rid of both. The method he hit upon was to run away from them, so he got up and ran, but every time he put his foot down there was another step, while his shadow kept up with him without the slightest difficulty. He attributed his failure to the fact that he was not running fast enough, so he ran faster and faster without stopping until he finally dropped dead. He failed to realize that if he merely stepped into the shade, his shadow would vanish, and if he sat down and stayed still, there would be no more footsteps." Zen. As Zen master Pai Chang says, "Shut your mouth, close your lips, and say something." The name Crazy Wisdom may have been coined originally to describe the antics and achievements of the Zen Buddhist masters, who used shouts, blows to the head, riddles, belly laughs, and blasphemy to awaken their disciples. A great Zen sage once cut off his eyelids so he could meditate longer without falling asleep. A student cut off his arm to demonstrate to the master that he was ready for the teachings. One master shouted so loudly that his disciple, although enlightened by the shout, became deaf. Another master killed a cat when his students failed to save it by saying the correct words. And stories abound of masters and disciples hitting each other with their staffs. Master Tokusan used to ask his disciples a question and then tell them, "If you answer yes, you get 30 blows of my staff. When you answer no, you get 30 blows of my staff just the same." Zen holy fools are out of their minds and want to drive you out of yours. Their madness is their message. When asked perfectly serious questions about the meaning of Zen or about the nature of mind or enlightenment, Zen masters often answer with statements such as, "The cypress tree is in the courtyard," "The cat is climbing the pole," "The moon is clearly visible," or, "Have you had your breakfast?" As R.H. Blythe says, "Zen is the unsymbolization of the world and all the things in it." Zen holy fools have clear, direct experience of the world from moment to moment, making them capable of continuous spontaneity and playfulness. Master Shi Kung asked the disciple if he could take hold of empty space. The disciple made a grasping movement in the air with his hand, but Shi Kung exclaimed, "You got nothing." The disciple then asked, "What then is your way?" Whereupon Shi Kung took hold of the disciple's nose, gave it a sharp twist, and called out, "That is the way to take hold of empty space." Another disciple once asked Zen Master Umon, "What is the Buddha?" Umon answered, "A dried dung stick." You see, Zen Buddhist crazy wisdom has no heroes. The Buddha and the idea of Buddhahood can also be bondage for the mind. Attachment to the Buddha is an obstacle to one's own freedom. And ironically, setting enlightenment as our goal ensures that we won't get there. Having an objective implies that we are headed someplace, that we are not here in this moment in which, if we could give up our spiritual ambition, we would already be enlightened. As Master Rinzai says, "Whatever you encounter, slay it at once. On meeting a Buddha, slay the Buddha. On meeting a patriarch, slay the patriarch. On meeting your parents, slay your parents. On meeting your kinsmen, slay your kinsmen." And then you attain emancipation. Zen holy fools consider only one thing to be holy, their moment-to-moment Zen. Zen requires constant homage to the eternal now. Master Ganto says, "If you want to know the last word, I'll tell you, simply, this. This!" We may not be aware of it, but at one time or another, each of us has probably paid homage to a famous Asian holy fool, the half-mythical, half-flesh-and-blood character named Hotai, better known as the Laughing Buddha. He is the pot-bellied figure whose statue appears in Chinese souvenir shops and restaurants, and who brings good luck if his stomach is rubbed. His hands are sometimes extended upward, as if he holds up the sky with his crazy dance, and a big silly grin always crosses his broad face. Supposedly, the Laughing Buddha was modeled after an actual wandering Chinese Zen monk named Keishi, who some people believe was Maitreya, another incarnation of Buddha who arrived unexpectedly in this jolly rotund form. By contrast, Gautama Buddha is traditionally depicted as trim, handsome, and extremely dignified, with perfectly symmetrical features and just the slightest of smiles, as faint as the Mona Lisa's. A passage in Orthodox Indian Buddhist literature claims that spiritually advanced people will display less pronounced laugh responses and that the most enlightened beings will not even show their teeth when they smile. Flying in the face of this stuffy monastic ideal, the folk hero Hotai came along to proclaim that you can be enlightened and still have a belly laugh. You can have great realizations of suffering and emptiness and yet emerge as a playful, joyous fat man who drinks a little wine now and then and would rather play hide-and-seek with children all day than chant sutras with a bunch of old monks in a stifling hot temple. This Laughing Buddha symbolizes an entire subculture of crazy wisdom artists, the wandering poet seekers of China and Japan, many of whom were also Taoist or Zen Buddhist monks. This spiritual poetic subculture spans centuries and includes some of the finest Asian writers and artists. They were usually great lovers of nature and wild places, and many of them became homeless wanderers. They shunned official religious institutions as well as the business of ordinary people, and chose to live free, practicing only their art and the art of liberation. The Japanese poet Ryokan sums up their path this way. "Abandon this fleeting world, abandon yourself, then the moon and flowers will guide you along the way." And now for some crazy Western wisdom. Understanding Eastern crazy wisdom requires a stretch, if not a complete snap, of the Western mind. A Zen poet once remarked, "It's like trying to discuss the color of milk with a blind man. The major difficulty comes from differing attitudes toward reason. Over the centuries, Eastern and Western seekers of wisdom have been involved in two somewhat different games of consciousness. Consider the following statements. First, Aristotle, who says, "Reason is the true self of every man, since it is the supreme and better part." But Lao Tzu says, "Stop thinking and end your problems." There seems to be a kind of east-west split in the world psyche. The planet seems to be divided in much the same way as the brain into two hemispheres, each with its own methods for understanding. Broadly speaking, Eastern and Western seekers of wisdom have taken two fundamentally different approaches. As Plato says, knowledge is virtue. As Chuang Tzu says, if you try to know it, you have already departed from it. Early on in their experiments with consciousness, Eastern sages attempted to gain control over their thoughts and emotions, and as they gazed inward, they found their rational mind to be an unreliable and often treacherous tool. The Eastern holy fools also saw the intellect as an agent of separation, concerned with manipulating the external world for self-preservation. They began to understand that the rational mind, although necessary to survival, leads to painful alienation from the rest of creation. But on the other side of the planet, the Western seekers of wisdom, beginning with the Greeks, became infatuated with the rational mind. They came to honor reason and the intellect as all but divine powers. Their belief in the mind's supremacy caused them to place humans above the rest of creation, fostering in the Western psyche an intense identification with the individual self or soul. The Western enterprise centered on developing the intellect and strengthening the self as a way of knowing and controlling the world. D.H. Lawrence writes, "The last 3,000 years of mankind have been an excursion into ideals, bodilessness, and tragedy, and now the excursion is over. We have to go back a long way before the idealist conceptions began, before Plato, before the tragic idea of life arose, to get back onto our feet again. For the gospel of salvation through the ideals and escape from the body coincided with the tragic conception of human life. Salvation and tragedy are the same thing, and they are now both beside the point." Most Western culture is the child of either of two gods, Jehovah or reason, the two dominant conceptions of the great Mediterranean cultures. We are the progeny of the ideas of Plato or the God of Moses. We are raised on the words or on the word. We are worshippers of signs and symbols. During that incredibly fertile period from approximately 500 to 200 BC, abstract thought must have shimmered off the surface of the Mediterranean Sea and settled into the human mind. On one side of the Mediterranean, the prophets of Judea proclaimed their faith in the word God. Scholars say this word God is an example of the Hebrews' great abstract genius. They were the first to worship a name rather than something that could be seen and touched. Meanwhile, on the other shore of the Mediterranean, Greek philosophers proclaimed the supremacy of a different species of abstraction. Beneath the shade of olive trees and stately pillars, Plato, the godfather of thinking, turned reason itself into a deity. Ironically, Plato built his religion of the mind on the reputation of Socrates, probably the best thinker of the time, and the one most deserving of the title of Crazy Wisdom Master. Socrates was turning truth upside down, and that is why the Greek authorities had him put to death. And here were the charges against him. "Socrates is an evildoer and a curious person, searching into things under the earth and above the heaven, and making the worse appear the better cause, and teaching all this to others." It seems probable that Socrates was a master at turning the truth on its head, and that Plato misrepresented the master's teaching. It is likely that Plato was to Socrates what Paul would be to Christ, turning crazy wisdom into dogma. Socrates was the Western Lao Tzu, a master of paradox, who stood all knowledge on end and claimed that all he knew was that he knew nothing. Plato, with his laws and ideals, was the Western Confucius, laying claim to knowledge of the highest wisdom for the ultimate good. If Plato captured anything of Socrates, it was his methods of working, which turn out to be the familiar techniques of crazy wisdom masters. Socrates wrote nothing down and took no money for teaching. He simply strolled around the porches of the agora, talking to whoever gathered around him. He held his audience by engaging in dialogue, inquiring with gentle irony into the nature of all knowledge and belief. As his influence grew, Socrates became a threat to the Greek authorities, and finally he was arrested for opposing Greek imperialism. He told the youth of Athens to refuse military service and to devote their lives to the pursuit of truth rather than wealth. Like Christ, Socrates would not recant or beg for mercy, and he was martyred for his beliefs. In the end, his attitude toward death reveals Socrates as a true master of crazy wisdom. He says, "We go our ways, I to die and you to live. Which is better, God only knows." Plato, the father of Western philosophy, sanctified logic and reason. Plato concluded that reason could acquaint us with the ultimate truth, and eventually he declared that he had figured out that truth once and for all. Plato claims that ideas are the ultimate reality. Individual objects, such as a specific chair, are partially real, and real only to the extent to which they partake of the idea of chair or the idea of chairness. In other words, the more a chair resembles the idea of chair, the more of a chair it is. At this point, a Taoist would sit down on any particular chair, even if it was only partially real. But Plato remained standing, gazing into the heavens for the ideal form, that grand piece of intellectual furniture that has not allowed the Western mind to rest for several millennia. Plato's statements about ideas, such as how the good is good because it partakes of goodness, are nothing but taut little tautologies. By placing ultimate faith in his mind, Plato tricked himself into violating the basic rules of logic. If only a Taoist or Zen master had wandered into one of Plato's dialogues, the Western world might have been spared some tight mental binds. As Plato talked about the good or the real, a Zen master would have interjected statements like, "Your toga is coming loose," or, "Please pass the dolmas." Maybe somebody would have picked up on the theme and developed a stream of Western wisdom concerned as much with being as with knowing. Although many blamed Descartes for the mind-body split, Plato made the first cut. Truth, he believed, is the product of the mind alone. The needs and desires of the body and senses lead men astray. Eventually, Plato's concept of the rule of the mind was narrowed further to become the rule of philosopher kings, whose authority must be obeyed unquestioningly because they alone know what is real and good. In The Republic, as well as in his last work, The Laws, Plato lays out his ideal state, complete with caste system, strong-standing military, a regimented educational structure for raising perfect citizens, and laws that would deny free speech and inquiry. Ironically, Plato's perfect society would have put Socrates to death, just as the actual Greek system had done. Plato's writing and thinking can be admired as part of the brilliant first flowering of abstract human reasoning. The difficulty comes with his insistence that reason is the sole and certain means of discovering truth. The refinement of reason has undoubtedly enabled the West to make astonishing achievements in science and technology and to gain phenomenal material benefits. However, this same intellectual power has led to the Western split of mind from body and of humans from the rest of creation. Most crazy wisdom masters would contend that Plato's philosophy directed us down the road to reasonable rack and possible ruin. If we do destroy ourselves, our only excuse and closing line may be, "Reason made us do it." Following in Plato's footsteps and becoming his footnotes, the classical Western philosophers offer us fascinating displays of abstract thinking. However, from the perspective of modern language philosophy, many of these discourses are meaningless, making use of vague words and concepts which refer to nothing but themselves. Looking back over Western philosophy from the vantage point of the 20th century, Ludwig Wittgenstein wrote, "The results of philosophy are the uncovering of one or another piece of plain nonsense, and of bumps that the understanding has got by running its head up against the limits of language." Classical Western philosophy made reason another messiah, incarnated to bring salvation. Imagine reason, the deity, a winged, perfectly shaped thought balloon lifting Western man up off the earth, out of body and nature. Hovering precariously there for centuries, we thought and thought and thought some more, but eventually we had to come back down to Earth. The crash was inevitable. The fateful blow to the head. The crazy wisdom. And now, the existential get down. We start with Albert Camus, who writes, "I want everything to be explained to me or nothing, and the reason is impotent when it hears this cry from the heart. The mind, aroused by this insistence, seeks and finds nothing but contradictions and nonsense. The world itself, whose single meaning I do not understand, is one vast irrational." And so, after a long history of brow-wrinkling, brain-twisting, mind-sweating reason, Western philosophy came to its own tentative brand of crazy wisdom. In the 18th and 19th centuries, Western thinkers began to arrive at the bitter conclusion that the intellect could not comprehend the world or its meaning. By the mid-20th century, the movement known as existentialism had pronounced the failure of reason and the death of classical Western philosophy. The existentialists wanted desperately to name and secure the world in their minds, but reason let them down. Like jilted lovers, many of them grew melancholy or bitter and lashed out at this once exalted human specialty. As Camus writes, "Forever I shall be a stranger to myself. In psychology, as in logic, there are truths, but no truth. Socrates's 'know thyself' has as much value as the 'be virtuous' of our confessionals. They reveal a nostalgia at the same time as an ignorance." The existentialists challenged both God and reason, and thus the Western claim that humanity had a special place in creation. We were no longer the chosen ones, watched over like children by God our Father, nor was our intellect capable of discovering truth or finding higher meaning for our lives. These conclusions, along with the work of Darwin and Freud, shattered the Western psyche. The individual mind and soul were no longer the centerpieces of creation, and it became the grim project of the existentialists to mourn their passing and write the elegies. The despair felt by these late Western philosophers was both personal and collective, regret for themselves and for their culture. What the existentialists lacked, although some of them yearned for it, was a way out of their minds. A few of them tried the way of the absurd. In the absurd of the existentialists, we hear echoes of the Tao. Both describe a non-rational cosmos, indifferent to human concerns as it sweeps everything along. Confronted with this absurd creation, Albert Camus wrote that something new is required. He states, "For the absurd man, it is not a matter of explaining and solving, but of experiencing and describing. Everything begins with lucid indifference." Any Eastern sage would be pleased with Camus' phrase, lucid indifference, which sounds similar to the just being of Zen or the deliberate non-doing of Taoism. However, unlike the Taoist at peace with the Tao, Camus himself never made peace with the absurd, and it is widely believed he committed suicide. He was well aware of his dilemma. He wrote, "If I were only a tree among trees, a cat among animals, this life would have a meaning, or rather, this problem would not arise, for I should belong to this world. I should be this world, to which I am now opposed by my whole consciousness and my whole insistence upon familiarity. This ridiculous reason is what sets me in opposition to all creation, and I cannot cross it out with a stroke of the pen." Camus wanted out of his mind and into being, but no Taoist or Zen master was around to give Camus lessons. There was no tradition in the West to accommodate his yearnings, no method to transform his existentialism into a way of life. He was a man of philosophy, and when the thinking game could not hold him up, he sank. Perhaps of all the existentialists, the 19th-century philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche came closest to forging a new approach to life based on a universe without God or reason. Although many disapprove of Nietzsche's occasional harsh tone, he certainly deserves the title of Western Crazy Wisdom Master. Inscribed over the door to Nietzsche's house, he had a sign which read, "I live in my own place, have never copied nobody even half, and at any master who lacks the grace to laugh at himself, I laugh. Nietzsche developed his own unique crazy wisdom philosophy, which has a great deal in common with the ideas and styles of the Eastern sages. In fact, there are moments when Nietzsche, exploring his wild anarchistic beliefs, sounds exactly like an old Taoist holy fool. He writes, "My demand upon the philosopher is known, that he take his stand beyond good and evil, and leave the illusions of moral judgment beneath himself. This demand follows from an insight which I was the first to formulate, that there are altogether no moral facts." Nietzsche believed European civilization was sunk in superstition and ignorance, holding on to worn-out myths and ideologies. He called for a revaluation of all values, and said, quote, "Mankind must become better and more evil." In statements like that one, we can hear the familiar Taoist sense of irony and paradox. And although Nietzsche was a philosopher, he often spoke like a spiritual seeker. He wrote, "I want once and for all not to know many things." Like most crazy wisdom masters, Nietzsche saw the human craving for knowledge and significance as a distressing quality, keeping us grim and out of balance. Nietzsche writes, "Gradually, man has become a fantastic animal that has to fulfill one more condition of existence than any other animal. Man has to believe, to know, from time to time, why he exists. His race cannot flourish without a periodic trust in life, without faith in reason in life. And also, again and again, the human race will decree from time to time, there is something at which it is absolutely forbidden to laugh." And so, at the end of the Western philosophical trail, the existentialists found crazy wisdom. But they seemed unable to find the Taoist and Zen masters' peace of mind. In the end, Jean-Paul Sartre may have best summarized the difficult existential position, as well as the previous two millennia of Western philosophy, with this simple assertion. He said, "Being has not been given its due." The Art of Crazy Wisdom. Guillaume Apollinaire, 1905. There is the poet to whom the muse dictates his chants. There is the artist whose hand is guided by an unknown being, using him as an instrument. Their reason cannot impede them. They never struggle, and their work shows no sign of strain. They are not divine, and can do without their selves. They are like prolongations of nature, and their works do not pass through the intellect. From the first human who picked up a stick to beat out a rhythm on a log or draw an animal's picture in the dirt, artists have given name and form to the mysteries. As agents of the Tao or Jesus or the absurd, artists have shown us the latest version of the truth. They have made crazy wisdom dance. The artist wails down the walls of oppression with a ram's horn saxophone, dances until the body becomes spirit, sits in a New York garret or on a Chinese mountaintop and writes poetry to the wind or the next lost generation, and constantly sings to us of other truths, crying, "Look, this too is how it is." Artists employ all the archetypal crazy wisdom disguises. As clowns, they transform their own bewilderment or wonder into art. As tricksters, they reveal our shadow nature, stepping boldly into the realms of sex, chaos, and death. As jesters, they parody our latest fashions and beliefs. However, as the great fool, an artist can bring us back to our senses, either by opening our eyes and ears to another reality, or else to this reality, the world around us that we ordinarily don't see. As Michel Foucault writes, "The poet is he who beneath the named, constantly expected differences, rediscovers the buried kinship between things, the scattered resemblances." James Joyce formulated a theory that defined the artistic experience as aesthetic arrest. According to Joyce, art does not have purpose. It exists neither to teach nor to motivate. Joyce insisted that works which evoke desire or disgust should be called propaganda. Art, in the purest sense, simply captures rhythms or relationships, and when it works, it causes an epiphany, the state of aesthetic arrest. In Joyce's theory, art immerses us in the moment, producing the same effect as the Zen masters shout or blow. The Zen poet R.H. Blythe would agree. He says, "Art is frozen Zen." Albert Camus has an existential theory of art that also sounds like a Zen master's aesthetic. For Camus, the artist embodies us in the world and the moment, with particulars, with stories, with things. As Camus saw it, art can teach us what science and reason cannot. Camus says, "A work of art is born of the intellect's refusal to reason the concrete. It marks the triumph of the carnal." In other words, great artists can stop the mind and can offer a sudden intuitive revelation, Satori. Like spiritual crazy wisdom masters, artists can enlighten us. They teach us how to be. They give us playthings, plays, and play. As John Cage writes, "Theater takes place all the time, wherever one is, and art simply helps persuade one that this is the case." A meaningless universe left the existential philosophers trembling in their lofts, but the artists began playing with the absurd, looking for colors and shapes in the void. At the beginning of the 20th century, artists calling themselves Dadaists, Futurists, and Surrealists transformed the absurd into art. Here's an excerpt from the Manifesto of Futurism, 1908. "Let's break away from rationality as out of a horrible husk, and throw ourselves like pride-spiced fruit into the immense, distorted mouth of the wind. Let's give ourselves up to the unknown, not out of desperation, but to plumb the deep pits of the absurd." Like great tricksters, the early 20th century artists decided to put a grin on the face of the absurd. They also were creating symbolic representations of a new ethos, finding a way to honor being itself, even if its meaning could not be understood, even if it had no ultimate meaning. Dadaism and Surrealism made acceptance of the absurd a badge of honor for those who could live with and even rejoice in a godless universe. The great Surrealist philosopher and artist André Breton wrote, "I believe in the pure Surrealist joy of the man who, forewarned that all others before him have failed, refuses to admit defeat, sets off from whatever point he chooses, along any other path save a reasonable one, and arrives wherever he can." These new 20th century artists were severing ties with all previous Western cultural norms. As foretold by Nietzsche, they had broken loose to create new realities and revel in the energy of existence. And they had a good time kicking in the windows of old institutions. Again, from the Manifesto of Futurism, "We will destroy museums, libraries, and fight against moralism and all utilitarian cowardice. We are on the extreme promontory of ages. Why look back, since we must break down the mysterious doors of impossibility? Time and space died yesterday. We already live in the absolute, for we have already created the omnipresent eternal speed." The artists of the early 20th century turned solid shapes into liquid ones, distorted human forms and faces, took apart words and their meaning, and even created new gods. Out of the imagination of some early 20th century artists came a madcap, multidimensional demigod known as Dada, which bears an uncanny resemblance to the Tao. The Dadaist movement was founded in Zurich during World War I by the French poet and self-proclaimed literary terrorist Tristan Tzara. Although Dadaist poetry and manifestos often sound like a takeoff of the Tao, we have absolutely no evidence that Tzara or the other Dadaists were acquainted with Taoist writings. Perhaps a mysterious transmission took place here. Here's Tristan Tzara, 1918. "Dada is a quantity of life in transparent, effortless, and gyratory transformation." And here's Lao Tse, 5th century B.C. "Tao never does anything, yet through it all things are done." Dada and the Tao seem to do the same dance, perhaps as partners, separated only by time. Even the sound of their names proclaim a relationship. Tao and Dada, Tse and Tzara. And the crazy wisdom likeness goes deeper. Here's Tristan Tzara from one of his many manifestos. He says, "Logic is a complication. Logic is always false. Dada suggests two solutions. No more looks, no more words, stop looking, stop talking. And here's Lao Tzu. Those who know don't talk. Those who talk don't know. In spite of their similarities, we must remember that Taoism has lasted for centuries and is ranked with the world's major philosophies. Dadaism is just bombast, a flippant artistic statement. Still, there is crazy wisdom in Dada. In a lecture, Tristan Tzara addressed the essence of the matter. I know you're expecting some explanations about Dada, but I'm not going to give you any. Explain to me why you exist. You have no idea. You'll say, I exist to make my children happy, but you know it's not really true. You'll say, I exist to protect my country from barbaric invasions. That's not enough. You'll say, I exist because God wants me to. That's a tale to tell the children. You'll never know why you exist, but you'll always allow yourself to be easily persuaded to take life seriously. You'll never understand that life is a play on words, because you'll never be alone enough to refuse hate and judgments and everything that needs a great effort in favor of an even, calm state of mind in which everything is equal and unimportant. Obviously, there is crazy wisdom in Dada. So how does crazy wisdom happen? What gyre of gene or bug of brain produces crazy wisdom in an individual? Is it born in the blood or can it be learned? Where does crazy wisdom get its vast perspectives on the cosmos? If crazy wisdom knows that we don't know, then how does crazy wisdom know that? Modern science may have discovered the seat of crazy wisdom, the right hemisphere of our cerebral cortex. Recent research has found that the human brain's two hemispheres tend to have separate functions and modes of operation. The left hemisphere seems to be in charge of logic, mathematics, and language activities, while the right hemisphere controls artistic sensibility and spatial judgment. The left hemisphere is the business center, the place where we work to survive. The right hemisphere is existential, the place where we live and love. The left gets us where we are going, the right puts us in touch with where we are. Long before we understood the function of each hemisphere, it was recognized that people have at least two modes of understanding. Philosopher Thomas Hobbes called one mode directed and the other free. Indian spiritual teacher Radhakrishnan called one rational and the other integral. French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss referred to one as positive and the other as mythic. A very poetic description of these two minds appears in the 2nd century Indian Buddhist text, the Lankavatara Sutra. The discriminating mind is a dancer and a magician with the objective world as his stage. Intuitive mind is the wise jester who travels with the magician and reflects upon his emptiness and transiency. The left hemisphere is the opposable thumb of the mind. It receives and orders information, analyzes the world, gives out names, and arranges sensory input in familiar patterns. The left hemisphere is an information processor, working bit by bit in a linear, sequential manner. The right hemisphere's primary function is synthesis, seeing relationships between things and providing an overview. This part of the brain connects the dots, but doesn't count them. One key to understanding the right hemisphere can be found in its association with music and poetry. Some studies have shown that people with left hemisphere brain damage who have lost most of their language ability can still sing the words to songs. Other patients start writing and speaking in poetry for the first time. The right hemisphere seems to control our awareness of the body. Patients with right hemisphere brain damage are sometimes unable to dress themselves, though their speech and reasoning abilities are intact. Perhaps one of the functions of the right hemisphere is to bring us down from the abstract world of words and ideas and to put us back into our bodies, giving us a sense of our physical presence on the earth. Our culture's ontological prejudice is obvious from the attitude of medical science toward brain injuries. If only the right hemisphere is damaged and no injury has occurred to language or logic functions, doctors consider it minor brain damage. Perhaps the doctors understand the brain primarily through their own left hemispheres. It is obvious that something is not working properly. How else can we explain the pollution and destruction of our environment or the mass murder of our own species? We don't seem to see the bigger pictures and how we fit into them. We are no longer in our bodies. We are not in our right minds. Some adventurous anthropologists believe that the new emergence of mysticism, feminism, and deep ecology are the species' attempt to regain equilibrium. Our survival instinct may be telling us to reawaken our more receptive modes of understanding. Even the obsession with sex, drugs, and rock and roll may be seen as an attempt to find relief from the oppression of the rational. A new and necessary mutation may be taking place, attempting to correct the cultural and evolutionary imbalances of the past few thousand years. As Carl Jung wrote, "We must be able to let things happen in the psyche. For us, this actually is an art of which few people know anything. Consciousness is forever interfering, helping, correcting, and negating, and never leaving the simple growth of the psychic processes in peace. It would be simple enough if only simplicity were not the most difficult of all things." And now it's time to work out with the holy fools. The sixth Chinese Zen patriarch says, "Do not give rise to a single thought." The holy fools want to drive us out of our minds, knowing that when we get there, the fresh air will do us good. Maybe we will begin to understand that we cannot understand and will relax a little. Only then will we begin to understand. One of the best ways, say the holy fools, is through meditation. The practice of meditation should not be confused with Western psychology, which studies an individual's personal history. In meditation, one learns to go beyond personality and become aware of the mechanics of the mind and emotions. Meditation teaches the physics of the psyche, the origin of thoughts and feelings, and how they interact. It can help to free us from our instincts as well as our ideologies. Meditation cultivates equanimity and peace in the mind. It frees us from the psyche's drama. Some Eastern holy fools say that meditation is a practice of being. Although it sounds contradictory, it seems that humans do have to practice being in order to be. Our tendency is always to analyze and adjust our environment, as though it were never quite right, or as if we were in constant danger. Meditation is a way to allow ourselves to be in the world as it is. Oscar Wilde once wrote, "To become a spectator of one's own life is to escape the suffering of life." And in some sense, meditation might be considered theater. Think of it as a ticket to step outside yourself in order to get some distance on your own little drama, to become not only an actor on the world stage, but a member of the audience as well. This helps us understand our personae as the masks that they are, the archetypes we are typecast to portray. As part of the audience, we can view the production we are in as a play, sometimes a parody, and at best a musical comedy. For some, it all looks like the theater of the absurd. The theater of meditation requires that part of the mind be trained as an observer, known as the witness, the other, or the higher self. Climb into the balcony of your mind and find a seat. Once you see yourself from up there, everything begins to look different. This point of reference is sometimes called a cosmic perspective. If you are going to practice this theater game, you might as well give your witness a sense of humor. No need to have a grim higher self. Put a wry, bemused smile on the face of your witness. Your cosmic perspective can also be a comic perspective. If we just get some distance, the cosmic and comic become one, and the joke is on all of us. But wait, there's another way of looking at things. Some meditation masters say the way to gain a cosmic perspective is to get out of our heads and back inside our bodies. They claim that the best seat in the house is located somewhere near the abdomen. Perhaps the best advice for gaining cosmic perspective is just to move. Wherever you are, you can't see where you are unless you go somewhere else. As Rumi says, "Journeys bring power and love back into you. If you can't go somewhere, move in the passageways of the self. They are like shafts of light, always changing, and you change when you explore them." And now some questions. Ever since we became aware of our own existence, humans have asked questions about the meaning of life. Who are we? Why are we? Where do we come from? What are we supposed to be doing here? We will explore those questions. with Coyote in the lead, a Taoist sage on our right, and the jester on our left, followed by a few Zen masters, a pack of clowns, and some artists, philosophers, and scientists, we now take up our poetry books and walking staffs and begin a journey through the mind of the world, tracking the river of questions to the foot of the tall mountain of answers. Once there, we will climb and explore, looking under rocks and inside of DNA molecules and gazing out over vast vistas of space-time to consider the perennial puzzles of the universe and our place in it. The scientists are very important to our journey, since they will provide many of the latest views of ourself and the universe. To ensure both a micro and macro perspective, our scientific community includes a physicist who sees in depth and an astronomer who sees far out. We will also bring along a biologist, a psychologist, an anthropologist, a geologist, and assorted other ologists, the truth holders of the current culture. The jester suggests that what we really need is a generalist, an astrophysio-biopsycho-anthro-geopaleontologist, to synthesize it all. That way we could save on supplies and overhead. Unfortunately, no such being exists. Where do we start? Let's imagine that one of our Zen masters, realizing that the first step is arbitrary, simply begins chanting, "Who, who, who?" Our journey begins with the most elementary enigma. Who do you think you are? A Serbian proverb answers, "Be humble, for you are made of dung. Be noble, for you are made of stars." In the beginning, about 15 billion years ago, according to the latest scientific evidence, there was a Big Bang, the great cosmic orgasm. Out of that first fireball came the spin of atoms and the pattern of molecules, the cooked and cooling contents of the cosmic soup, blasting away from itself in all directions with a mighty roar that still echoes in the sea and in our voices. At the moment of that bang, the forces that brought us to be what we are in this moment were set in motion. Later, only 3,500 million years ago, a bolt of lightning struck the oozing primal mud with such force and finesse that it turned chemistry into biology. The combination of electricity and chemicals started off the multiple mutations that became us, the strange species of protoplasm we call human, conscious of ourselves and aware that we will die, capable of creating vast mythologies and lilting bridges, spinning through space on this lukewarm blue-green sphere without any idea of why we are here or what we are supposed to be doing here. Who are we, and how do we fit into the bigger picture? And why do we place such grave importance on our lives and the life of our species? Has some poorly built survival mechanism made us into awkward egocentrics and human chauvinists? Looking back on the long, difficult road of evolution, covering 3.5 billion years, what makes us believe we are its final destination? Let's take a close look at ourselves, with the help of a physicist and a biochemist. Let's see now. Looking closely, we find that our body is made up of approximately 90% water. The jester calls it the sublime slime. As we investigate further, we find that this water, along with everything else in our body, is made entirely of atoms. Looking even closer, we find that those atoms are almost entirely empty space. Now, if our body is made of atoms, and atoms are just empty space, then what is holding our clothes on? Not only does the emperor have no clothes, the clothes have no emperor. Maybe all of us are just illusions in somebody else's magic act. At this point, a Zen master smashes through our illusion with his staff. And through the pain, we have to conclude that human beings are real, after all. It is even possible that we are the most important reality of all. We know we want to be. We would like to believe that the gear in our brain that we call consciousness has separated us from the rest of creation for a reason. After all, this consciousness, along with the opposable thumb, has given us a tenuous mastery over our environment. What other creature can remove a piece of tree and make chopsticks from it? Which other species buys insurance? Nonetheless, there are those among us who do not believe we are so great. Mark Twain, for example, held the opinion that we are a poorly built species. In Satan's Letter from the Earth, Twain writes, "Man is constantly inflicted with a defect, the moral sense. It is the secret of his degradation. It is the quality which enables him to do wrong. Without the moral sense, man could do no wrong. He would rise at once to the level of the higher animals. Twain saw the human species as disjointed, out of harmony with itself and the rest of creation. His opinion is that we are on the bottom rung of evolution's ladder. He writes, "We have descended and degenerated from some far ancestor, some microscopic atom wandering at its pleasure between the mighty horizons of a drop of water, perchance, insect by insect, animal by animal, reptile by reptile, down the long highway of smirchless innocence, till we have reached the bottom stage of development, nameable as the human being. Below us, nothing. Nothing but the Frenchman." Quite a few psychologists would agree with Twain, reminding us that for the most part we are unconscious, barely aware of or in control of ourselves, often ruled by much the same forces as those beings we call the lower animals. Coyote winks. And one more thing. Even if humans are at the top of the evolutionary ladder, we sure did step on a lot of toes getting here. Passenger pigeon toes and the three toes of the three-toed sloth, just to name a few. Since the story isn't over yet, we might well ask, who or what will step on human toes on their climb to the top? But what about our big brains? Fossil records show that approximately 1 million years ago, the human brain suddenly began to grow at an unprecedented rate, adding about 1 cubic inch every 100,000 years. Then the growth rate doubled and doubled again until the brain was growing by 10 cubic inches every 100,000 years. Some scientists speculate that the phenomenal growth was triggered by a great ice age, the first in hundreds of millions of years. At the time the glaciers were advancing, humans had already migrated to northern regions of the Earth, and the drastic climate change required them to develop many new survival skills. Some scientists speculate that the brain's sudden growth was stimulated by that situation. In other words, it may have been ice that started the fire in our skulls. Our great ingenuity could simply be the result of being cold. Consciousness may be nature's way of shoveling snow. What then can we make of the elaborate civilizations that have evolved during the last few 100,000 years? Perhaps they are side effects of nervous energy left over from our struggle to conquer the elements, energy that continues to find outlets in nuclear bombs and symphonies and skyscrapers full of people writing coded messages to one another. Perhaps war itself is a response left over from a time of competition for sparse resources, a time dominated by our fear of the cold. Maybe that same fear started the Cold War. All that we do today may be the final shivers of an age, not so long ago, when we did not have central heating. Many new scientific discoveries raise great doubts about our lofty place in the cosmic scheme. Compounding those doubts are the current planetary crises, which call into question our ability to survive as a species and therefore our claim to a special destiny. The doubts and questions of the current age are deeply disturbing to our individual and collective egos. Are we the Creator's pets or just another complex chemical compound? Is the state of consciousness uniquely human, or is there consciousness everywhere, and if so, did we get the wrong dose? Are we stuck in a transitional time warp, our lives merely a phase like the one between fish and frog, crawling from sea to land in an evolutionary midlife crisis? Will we need to grow a new kind of eyelid to survive the blinding light to come, or a new type of lung to breathe thicker air? Must we go back to webbed feet to navigate the landscape after the oceans rise? What part of our anatomy will begin to grow and lead us to our next destiny? What sleek new species is waiting to be born from our dilemmas? And meanwhile, what genetic backwater has left us washed up on the shore of this age, gasping for breath, caught between what we were and what we will yet become? What unknowable, perfect plan could have designed us like this, floundering between feelings of self-importance and doubt? In the big story of life, who could we be? Scientist Robert Ardrey offers this guess. He says, "We are the missing link." What Western science is discovering about the human condition conforms with what Eastern holy fools have understood for centuries. As Rumi says, "Do you think I know what I'm doing? that for one breath or half breath I belong to myself? As much as a pen knows what it's writing, or the ball can guess where it's going next. It seems to come down to this. Not only are we not in charge of the cosmos or the planet, we are barely in charge of ourselves. This is especially shocking to the Western worldview, as Freud noted in the early 20th century. He wrote, "Humanity has in the course of time had to endure from the hands of science two great outrages upon its self-love. The first was when it realized that our Earth was not the center of the universe. The second was when biological research robbed man of his peculiar privilege of having been specially created and relegated him to descent from the animal world, implying an ineradicable animal nature in him. But man's craving for grandiosity is now suffering the third and most bitter blow from present-day psychological research, which is endeavoring to prove to the ego in each one of us that he is not even master in his own house." We may never know the extent to which we are free, but it seems safe to say that we attribute to ourselves much more freedom than we actually have. Most people feel they act independently from moment to moment, and few of us ever considered the degree to which we control our individual lives. We simply assume that we have free will. Meanwhile, the latest evidence from the biology labs indicates that each of us is shackled to a genetically determined future, bound by the chains of the DNA double helix. We are imprisoned in ourselves. Biogenetics tells us that the DNA molecule determines how tall we will grow and how strong our teeth will be, what illnesses we are likely to contract, and to some degree, how long we will live. It is as if we are each born into a spy novel, and as the plot unfolds, our identity is gradually revealed. And if that's not enough, our genes provide each of us with a face that we must wear from birth. A thick head of hair, or a nearsighted squint, or a lopsided ears, these are features that affect how the world looks at us, and therefore how we look back at the world. On the physical level, at least, we are not free to be ourselves. We are forced to be ourselves. Our belief in freedom is also seriously challenged by recent brain research, which reveals that humans actually have three brains, a reptilian brain, a mammalian brain, and the new cerebral cortex, or human brain. Although we make maximum use of our reptilian and mammalian brains, experiments show we use only about 15% of our new human brain. Writer and educator Joseph Chilton Pierce speculates that we use this 15% only to rationalize the reactive behavior of our reptilian and mammalian brains. In other words, what we call consciousness is simply the ability to make up excuses for ourselves. Someday, evolution may provide us with a different type of self-awareness, which will allow us the freedom to act instead of just react. We may need to become conscious in a more profound sense of the word before we can be free. As the poet Robert Bly states, "The reptile brain has embodied itself in the outer world in the form of a tank, which even moves like a reptile. A saint is someone who has managed to move away from the reptile and mammal brains and is living primarily in the new brain." From another angle, psychologists tell us that our early upbringing determines who we become. As infants, we ingest our parents and then spend the rest of our lives trying to digest them. We eat them whole, from their genes to their judgments. Even if we rebel against them, they shape that rebellion. Their voices continuously echo inside of us. We never leave home. So why do we have the profound conviction that we are free and independent beings who shape and control our own destinies? Can we make a case for some degree of individual autonomy? Chuang Tzu offers a paradoxical answer. He says, "Let your mind wander in simplicity. Blend your spirit with the vastness. Follow along with things the way they are, and make no room for personal views. Then the world will be governed." Next, we ask the question, why are we here? Franz Kafka answers, "The meaning of life is that it stops." Contemporary street wisdom informs us that life's a bitch and then you die. This could be the first line of a couplet ending with the line, "and nobody knows the reason why." Existential uncertainty is difficult, if not impossible, for many people to live with. Knowledge is our survival mechanism, and we have a nervous biological craving to know what is going on. We want to be certain about the meaning of our lives, and if we can't find certainty in knowledge, then many will turn to blind faith. Samuel Beckett thinks that blind is the only kind of faith there is. As when his character Vladimir says, "What are we doing here? That is the question. And we are blessed in this, that we happen to know the answer. Yes, in this immense confusion, one thing alone is clear. We are waiting for Godot to come." We can't accept that life is nothing more than the moments between birth and death. That would be too absurd. Our existence, our suffering, must have some greater significance, and if the universe won't tell us what it is, then we will have to make something up. Enter the multitude of gods and religions. Choose one of the above. In this secular age, many old gods have been replaced with ideologies or isms or nation-states or even lifestyles. If we can't discover the one supreme reason for existing, we will create relatively satisfying earthbound purposes, a utopian future or freedom or progress or the children or all the gusto. We also have Joseph Campbell's view. He says, "I don't believe life has a purpose. Life is a lot of protoplasm with an urge to reproduce and continue in being." So, maybe that's all we're here to do. Go forth and multiply. Just be and beget and be and beget and be and beget until some cosmic catastrophe ends it all. Or maybe one great truth or purpose does exist for which all of us are living and we just don't know it yet. One day we may discover we were put here to develop the best possible basketball team for the intergalactic tournament, or to serve as hosts for microbes that are the Creator's true chosen ones. Or maybe we are part of someone's experiment to determine whether we can figure out why we are here, and our confusion, like that of rats in a maze, is the whole point. Perhaps someday the one true God or Goddess will appear and say, "Nobody got my name right." Or maybe all deities exist, but none of them are good, and they take no interest in whether or not we are good. Could it be that all these years we have only been good for goodness' sake? Maybe all of our questions will be answered one day. Maybe they won't. Gertrude Stein claims she has found the answer. She writes, "There ain't no answer. There ain't going to be any answer. There never has been an answer. That's the answer." But this raises another question. If we aren't meant to know, then why do we ask? Why? 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 What kind of joke is this? Why do we carry the Y chromosome? Where will our question lead us? A Yiddish saying tells us, "God made man because he loves stories." Let's assume that we are here to provide stories. Here's a good one. Once upon a time, in fact only 400 years ago, most Westerners believed that the Earth was located at the very center of the universe. Then a great scientist named Galileo figured out that the Earth circles the Sun, and therefore the Sun must be the center. But the Catholic Church believed that humans had been specially created, and therefore the Earth had to be the center of the universe, so the Church forced Galileo to recant. This took place back in the 1630s. The Church finally forgave Galileo in 1979. But by then, astronomers and physicists had discovered that the Sun itself is a relatively small star, located on the edge of a relatively small galaxy in a cosmos that includes billions of galaxies filled with uncountable billions of stars. The Vatican made no further pronouncement as to the center of the universe. Where is the center of the universe, and where are we in relation to it? Have we been pushed into the wings? Is the Earth just a backdrop for a truly meaningful drama happening thousands of galaxies away, and humanity merely a crowd of extras spinning around the lead characters who play their parts on center stage light years from Earth? Like any crazy wisdom story, this one has yet another twist. Astronomers have recently concluded that the Big Bang sent everything in this space-time continuum moving away from everything else uniformly in all directions, so that, in fact, every single point in the universe can be considered the center. That's you. You are still the center of the universe, and humanity is the center of the universe, just as we always hoped and believed we were. And now the question, what do you know? John Dalton, the British chemist and physicist responsible for the modern conception of atomic theory, said in 1803, "Thou knowest no man can split the atom." And Lord Kelvin, a British mathematician, physicist, and president of the British Royal Society, said in 1895, "Heavier-than-air flying machines are impossible." Looking back on the history of knowledge, it becomes clear that it changes at least every century and is different in each civilization. Still, most people believe that what they know about the world is true. For example, people once knew for a fact that the world was flat, that the sun went around the earth, and that space was filled with something called ether. Indeed, it seems something of a miracle that we have managed to survive our own ignorance. For example, Johann Hartmann, a 17th-century chemistry professor, was highly regarded in his time for his medical knowledge. He wrote, "For epilepsy in adults, I recommend spirit of human brain or a powder to be compounded only in May, June, and July from the livers of live green frogs." In spite of being wrong, many ideas seem to have worked just fine for the people who knew them to be true. When the world was flat, nobody sailed out too far. When the sun rotated around the earth, people still harvested their crops in the right season. Religious beliefs don't seem to have affected human destiny much more than scientific ones. When Zeus, rather than Jehovah, ruled the heavens, life was about the same, a mixture of joys and sorrows. The quality of life may not have much to do with knowledge or belief. And perhaps the quest for any kind of certainty is doomed to failure. Taoists and Dadaists and good historians would all bow to that. Even scientists tell us there is no fixed objective knowledge. Nothing is independent of our subjective observations. In the end, there may be no objective truth, only projective truth. What we find always depends on what we are looking for. What we look for depends on who we are and what we think we need to know. The questions are always part of the answer. At best, knowledge has always been double-edged, both a blessing and a curse. The biblical story says that the pursuit of knowledge got us kicked out of the Garden of Eden. If Eve hadn't wanted to know what was going on, she wouldn't have eaten of the tree. And today we might still be in paradise, wandering blissfully in naked innocence, passing time by naming things and enjoying the fruits that give no knowledge but sure do taste good. Our thirst for knowledge seems to come from pride and fear, from our belief that we can know everything, and from our insecurity when we don't. So we keep searching for the key that will unlock the fundamental mysteries. In the 20th century, scientific materialism has led us to look for answers inside of matter itself, as if by taking apart the world we could find a clue to the secrets of creation. But scientists split matter open, and then they split it open again and again, and when they finally got to the atom, they split that open, and inside the atom they did find the essence of all matter, and lo and behold, it was energy. The tremendous pure power of the cosmos was hiding there inside the smallest of all things, holding matter together with an intricate and unimaginable force. There was knowledge inside that atom, just as there was knowledge inside the apple, and by discovering it, we may have angered the gods again. In our urgency to know, we have once again dared to steal the fire, the hidden sacred knowledge that could drive us even farther from the garden. The knowledge we obtained from eating the apple in the Garden of Eden was the knowledge that divided up the universe and separated us from creation. However, the knowledge acquired from splitting the atom showed us that, at the most basic level, all things are one. Maybe we are back where we started, before the fall. In splitting the atom, physicists found that matter and energy can't be separated. So we are left with matter-energy, a reality held together by the dash. Space-time requires the same dash. Some people even write the Almighty's name with a dash, G-D. Maybe the dash in the middle is the key to everything. Maybe it's a minus sign. In fact, ultimate knowledge may exist in the dash itself, in the joining together of all realities. The understanding that the Taoists, 10,000 things of this world are actually one. Inside the dash, our logic and language cannot survive, but it may be the place where crazy wisdom lives. We know that all things require their opposite. Dark is necessary to light. Death is necessary to life. Now needs then. Yin is always getting ready to yang, and down is up and down simultaneously. To accept paradox is to accept what appears to be the fundamental law of nature and rule of life. It might be that you can have your cake and eat it too, but you can't have your cake and eat it too. Or, as physicist Niels Bohr put it, a great truth is a truth whose opposite is also a great truth. And now, crazy wisdom in the 20th century. As the French philosopher Diderot said, what a fine comedy this world would be if one did not play a part in it. The forces of change are having a great romp through the 20th century, causing the planet itself to wobble in its orbit. In the past 100 years, the human species has experienced an unprecedented explosion of information and inventions, nothing less than a revolution in our evolution. In a burst of speed, humans have invented fantastic tools and toys and awesome new terrors that have transformed the landscapes of our psyches and continents. An ice age's worth of changes in less than a century. Within a minute of historical time, we have redesigned the surface of our planet and redefined ourselves. In just a few brief decades, our prevailing ways of life have been transformed from religious to secular, rural to urban, and industrial to technological. The advent of airplanes, automobiles, radios, movies, televisions, and computers have scrambled cultures and customs worldwide. Every god and every flag in every corner of the planet has been challenged by the knowledge, if not the direct intervention, of gods and flags from other regions. Nothing remains as it was, and no one is left untouched. Fortunately, in this time of tremendous upheaval, crazy wisdom is flourishing again. As Woody Allen says, more than at any time in history, mankind faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness, the other to total extinction. Let us pray that we have the wisdom to choose correctly. Once we had an Iron Age, and now we live in the age of irony. The rapid changes of the last 100 years show us that there may be no such thing as progress, that for every step forward we take at least one step backward. Maybe we don't even know forward from backward. In this time of great change, some have begun to see humanity as nothing more than a species of clowns, wobbling precariously on a shaky rung of the evolutionary ladder, wondering if this support system will hold us, wondering whether the ladder is even leaning against the right wall. And nobody appears qualified to clear things up for us. Unless, of course, God is waiting for the auspicious year 2000 to show his or her face. In the meantime, we seem to be on our own. In a standard 20th century cartoon image, a dignified man wearing top hat and tails walks jauntily along, self-assured and proud, and he is about to slip on a banana peel. We can put our entire civilization under that top hat. We feel so proud of our progress, certain of our direction, convinced of our understanding, and, whoops, hey, what about this ozone layer? Who knew about the greenhouse effect? Overpopulation? Nuclear waste? Why didn't somebody tell us that this might happen? That banana peel could have been left by coyote. Or maybe it's the contemporary equivalent of the fool's cliff. In our wondrous and dangerous world, both congratulations and condolences are in order, because Dickens's words on the French Revolution still apply today. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. In the 20th century, one of crazy wisdom's favorite personae is that of the mad scientist. Dressed in a white lab coat, hair disheveled, eyes bulging behind thick glasses, crazy wisdom does its magic act in laboratories and think tanks, making things appear and disappear and revealing paradox at every turn. In its new guise as science, crazy wisdom has received more credibility these days than it's had since the flowering of Taoism long, long ago. For centuries, spiritual crazy wisdom masters have believed that consciousness is the essential ingredient of any reality. Modern physics seems to confirm this idea by showing that we can alter reality, at least on the subatomic level, simply by observing it. For example, experiments show that an electron can be both a particle and a wave at the same time, depending on how we look at it, and perhaps on whether we look at it at all. Some physicists say that particles exist only when an observer is present. In fact, one of the most widely accepted explanations of quantum physics, the Copenhagen interpretation, states categorically, there is no reality in the absence of observation. Okay, there is no reality in the absence of observation. So then if everyone closes their eyes simultaneously and ignores reality, maybe it will go away. Let's give it a try. Unfortunately, someone is always peeking. For the past decade or so, scientists have also talked about antimatter, claiming that an entire universe of antimatter exists, a sort of mirror image of our familiar universe of matter. The discovery of antimatter raises some important questions. Now we have to ask ourselves not only what is the matter, but also what is the antimatter? And more importantly, what does the antimatter have against the matter? And more importantly, does it matter? A haiku. No mind, no matter. No matter, never mind. If you find it hard to keep up with all the new scientific knowledge, you might find solace in the 100th monkey theory. This theory claims that if enough members of a species learn something new, the entire species will spontaneously begin to understand it. Biologist Rupert Sheldrake formulated a hypothesis that may explain how this phenomena works. He claims that new behaviors or ideas can spread through a species from a vibratory process called morphic resonance. Practically speaking, this means that if we just relax and wait a while, enough people will read up on this theory and we won't have to. Sometimes it's okay to let ourselves be the 101st monkey. Maybe we should take turns. And in the end, science becomes mythology. For millennia, humans have believed in things they could not see, gods and ghosts galore. Think of Plato's ideal forms, the Buddha's nirvana, the Christian vision of heaven. Indeed, often we imbue these invisible realms and phantoms with more reality than the things we can actually see and touch. Over the centuries, shamans and high priests have told us about the spirits who spoke only to them, and most of us believed their stories, no matter how fantastic. Now we believe the scientist shamans, who tell us of strange, invisible worlds far beyond ordinary perception and comprehension. Even the scientists themselves admit they haven't seen the subatomic realms, only traces that indicate they exist, and yet we have faith in their descriptions. Science may have finally moved into the realm of myth or poetry. Its theories read like mystical visions. Its equations are a new system of hieroglyphs. Perhaps contemporary scientists are simply giving us new symbols for the incomprehensible mysteries of the universe. We should be aware that the latest scientific truth corresponds to our sensory perception of reality, no better than the biblical version did. Science is just another set of names for the unknowable. Perhaps someday we will worship the forces and elements that are being discovered today. After all, the core of any religion is stories about the beginning and end of creation, and scientists are now writing a new scripture. In reality, 20th century science has taken us nowhere. We might as well be back in 500 B.C. when a Greek named Democritus wrote, "By convention, sweet is sweet. By convention, bitter is bitter. By convention, hot is hot. By convention, cold is cold. Color is color. But in reality, there are only atoms and the void." Democritus must be forgiven for thinking that atoms are real. He did not have the atom-smashing machines and lasers which have allowed today's physicists to discover that the solidity of atoms, too, is myth. In the end, only the void may be real. Neurophysicist Carl Priebum suggests that the universe may be most like a hologram. Perhaps you can step right through the walls of reality if you know the secret word. At the same time that Democritus of Greece was looking into the atomic nature of things, Gautama the Buddha in India realized that even atoms, which were then called kalapas, could be broken down into even smaller units. The Buddha made up a new word, astikalapa, to refer to subatomic particles. Furthermore, he said that these subatomic particles transform themselves trillions of times in the blink of an eye. Today, scientists have isolated subatomic changes that do indeed take place trillions of times a second. How did the Buddha figure that out? Could he have slowed his mind down to the point that he actually saw events occurring in trillionths of a second? Impossible! Unless, of course, the Buddha had developed a mental power equivalent to an atom-smashing machine and laser camera. Before we leave the universe of modern science, Crazy Wisdom wants to remind us of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and Einstein's theory of relativity, the two swords of modern science that undercut the whole science game. The uncertainty principle says that we can't really know subatomic reality because it changes whenever we try to measure it. The theory of relativity claims that all measurements and judgments depend on the observer's position and velocity. In other words, neither scientist nor subatomic reality can be pinned down. The observer and the observed seem to be locked in an eternal dance with each other, both unable to stop long enough for a clear picture to be taken. There can be no objectivity, no absolute truth in science. We can't know reality because we are inside of it. We are it. So now, let us go to church. The latest version. The First Church of Science. We are in St. Isaac and Albert's Cathedral, named after Newton and Einstein. The circular ceiling is a large revolving planetarium. It displays a continuously accurate view of the heavens to the very limit of astronomical exploration, billions of light-years away. In the cathedral's alcoves stand holograms of the saints of science, each captured at the moment of their revelation. Heraclitus stands in his ever-changing river. Galileo looks through his telescope at the stars. Euclid holds his ruler and triangle. Newton poses, a ripe apple on his head. Einstein stands in front of a curved mirror sticking out his tongue. Schrödinger has his cat on his shoulder. Heisenberg looks uncertain. The chapel's stained glass windows are scenes from the story of evolution. As we first enter the church, we see present-day Homo sapiens. As we move down the aisle toward the altar, we move backward through time. The last window before reaching the altar shows a one-celled organism. On pedestals flanking the altar sit two giant statues, replicas of a hydrogen and helium atom. Across the sanctuary wall, enlarged and electrified models of other atoms spin in their orbits, crashing into each other and exploding in flashes of light, giving churchgoers a sense of the dynamic reality of charged particles. Where the Christian crucifix or Ark of the Torah normally stands, we find the sacred symbol of the First Church of Science, an emblem of six white dots on a black field, representing six known quarks. The Holy Sextet, up, down, top, bottom, strange and charmed. The basic reality, amen. The black field represents the emptiness from which everything sprang, or the black hole from which it emerged, or perhaps the dark area, the first cause, the mystery that remains to be solved. We enter the church during a service. Each member of the congregation, dressed in a white lab coat, recites the liturgy. Hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, and so on, through the periodic table. Then the supplicants bow their heads and pray that the theory of everything will soon make itself known. Finally, the congregation chants the First Church of Science's own Hail Mary, its Shema Yisrael, its great mantra, Atom Aham, Atom Aham. And then God said, Let there be crazy wisdom. We begin with a quote from George Bernard Shaw, who wrote, All great truths begin as blasphemies. The 20th century has been a rough time for God, as well as for God's creatures. In the 1960s, the cover of a Time magazine posed the question, Is God dead? The jester laughs and says, Of course our gods are not dead. They're just having a midlife crisis. The gods and goddesses we believe in define who we are, and therefore each is, in some sense, our creator. And whichever gods and goddesses we worship, we end up worshiping life itself. We worship ourselves. In the past few centuries, as the world has shrunk, we have become aware of a vast array of gods and religions. The number and variety of beliefs should cast some doubt on all of them. Let's step back now for a few minutes and walk that thin 20th century line between blasphemy and a healthy humorous skepticism as we investigate the 100,000 names of God. The Greek philosopher Xenophanes was one of the first to realize that the heavens must be crowded. He wrote, "The Ethiopians say that their gods are snub-nosed and black. The Thracians say that their gods have light blue eyes and red hair." According to the Judeo-Christian tradition, a male god named Jehovah created the heavens and the earth and everything else in just 6 days. The Bible says that God looked at his creation and saw that it was good. Some think this could be the first recorded use of irony. For a different creation story, we go to a Bantu tribe in Africa whose creator is named Bumba. In the beginning, Bumba was alone except for darkness and water. Suddenly he was smitten with agonizing stomach pains and he vomited out the sun, the moon, and all living creatures. Now that sounds plausible. The universe is the product of a stomach ache. If you happen to be from the central region of Southwest Africa, you would probably believe in the sky god Nambi, whose name can only be spoken or written on special occasions. Hopefully, this was one of them. Meanwhile, goddesses are returning to the West. If we're lucky, they will arrive in time to save us from further mythological machismo. Crazy wisdom followers may enjoy praying to the ancient female Chinese creator named Nugua, who formed the first human beings from yellow clay. She also invented the flute. Nugua sounds like a sweet, playful deity, and it might be nice to crawl into her lap for some great mother nurturing. Nicer, at least, than to beg mercy or await judgment from a wrathful, jealous, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," male deity, whose name we shall not utter. As Joseph Campbell pointed out, in our religion, everything is prosaic and very, very serious. You can't fool around with Yahweh. Strange as it may seem, many people with access to information about the multitude of other gods still believe that theirs is the only God, and religions still try to convert people from one God to another. In the summer of 1985, when Pope John Paul visited the Republic of Central Africa, he performed communion at a gathering of tens of thousands of people. When he was finished, symbolically eating the body and drinking the blood of his god, he then gave a speech and told the Africans to stop practicing voodoo. As Cole Porter once asked, "Hoodoo, that voodoo." Speaking of the Pope, satirist Paul Krassner once said that Pope John Paul would be more popular if he called himself Pope John Paul George and Ringo. Through the ages, one of the jester's favorite pastimes has been lampooning gods and religions. Ever since humans first decided that there was a creator who controlled things, ever since the first prayer or sacrifice was sent upward in the hopes that something would be sent back down, crazy wisdom jesters have been busy laughing and spreading doubt. The 20th century has fostered some particularly inspired irreverence. For instance, writer Philip Wiley observed that if Jesus came back today, he would be killed again, but this time he would probably be electrocuted. And from that moment on, people would start wearing little electric chairs on chains around their necks. Unfortunately, very few believers seem to have much of a sense of humor about their beliefs. The gods themselves don't seem to have much of a sense of humor, or much perspective on themselves either. Despite being gods, they just can't seem to see the bigger picture. H.L. Mencken would like us to have a little sympathy for the gods. Looking back through history, he realized that the gods die too, just as surely as humans do. In a piece called Memorial Service, Mencken asks, "Where is the graveyard of dead gods? What lingering mourner waters their mounds? There was a time when Jupiter was the king of the gods, and any man who doubted him was a barbarian and an ignoramus. But where in all the world is there a man who worships Jupiter today? Tezcatlipoca was almost as powerful. He consumed 25,000 virgins a year. Lead me to his tomb. I would weep and hang a medal there. But who knows where it is, or where the grave of Quetzalcoatl is, or that of Dis, whom Caesar found to be the chief god of the Celts? Where are the graves of these gods, almighty gods in their day, worshipped by millions? Men labored for generations to build vast temples to them, temples with stones as large as hay wagons. The business of interpreting their whims occupied thousands of priests, wizards, bishops, and archbishops. To doubt them was to die, usually at the stake. Armies took to the field to defend them against infidels. Villages were burned, women and children were butchered, cattle were driven off. Yet in the end, these gods all withered and died, and today there is none so poor to do them reverence. H. L. Mencken. And in closing, we offer a moment of silence for all those gods and goddesses who have passed away. And now, news of the late 20th century. As the century draws to a close, news of war and the nuclear arms race is slowly losing its premier position in the headlines and is being replaced by news of global warming, deforestation, and other threats to the environment. It seems inevitable that without the Cold War, heat will become the major threat to human survival, the heat of our civilization, created by the burning of energy to fuel excessive speed and greed. It threatens to destroy us. Ironically, the fear of nuclear winter is giving way to concern over what might be called pollution summer. Little doubt remains that saving the planet, the forests, the oceans, the atmosphere, will demand humanity's full attention in the 21st century. The balance of nature will become far more important than the balance of power. Environmental crises will probably dominate the headlines of the 21st century. In response, a crazy wisdom perspective is likely to emerge as the next version of truth. The Gaia hypothesis and deep ecology are two visions that express the unity of all creation, which seems to be the emerging paradigm and someday may even direct the policy of nations. The Gaia hypothesis is based on the theory that our planet functions as a single organism. We cannot damage any part without damaging the whole. Similarly, deep ecology proposes that humans are neither separate from nor more important than the rest of nature. These ideas can be traced back to the Taoists, Zen Buddhists, Native Americans, Romantic poets, and early American Transcendentalists. The deep ecologists are proclaiming once again the unity of all things and being itself as a state of grace. A visionary eco-poet named appropriately John Seed writes that with the vision of unity, alienation subsides. He writes, "The human is no longer an outsider, apart. As your memory improves, as the implications of evolution and ecology are internalized and replace the outmoded anthropocentric structures in your mind, there is an identification with all life. Then follows the realization that the distinction between life and lifeless is a human construct. Every atom in this body existed before organic life emerged 4,000 million years ago. Remember our childhood as minerals, as lava, as rocks? And while it is true that human nature, revealed by 12,000 years of written history, does not offer much hope that we can change our warlike, greedy, ignorant ways, the vastly longer fossil history assures us that we can change. We are that fish and the myriad other death-defying feats of flexibility which a study of evolution reveals to us. A certain confidence, in spite of our recent humanity, is warranted. From this point of view, the threat of extinction appears as the invitation to change, to evolve. The change that is required of us is not some new resistance to radiation, but a change in consciousness. Deep ecology is the search for a viable consciousness. As humanity moves on to new crises, no doubt some people will look for a scapegoat for our environmental situation. Who is responsible for the threats to our life support system? It may be impossible to find a culprit. No one could have known, for instance, that using chlorofluorocarbons would eat away the ozone shield. We assume that former President Richard Nixon's close friend Robert Aplanalp, who made his fortune in aerosol sprays, had no idea his product would contribute to one of the most threatening environmental crises since Noah's time. Nor could Henry Ford have predicted the environmental havoc that would result from his mass production of automobiles. If he had the foresight, would he have started up that first assembly line? And after Hiroshima, Albert Einstein said of his life's work, "If I had known they were going to do this, I would have become a shoemaker." In spite of it all, most holy fools would say that there is no evil in the world, only ignorance. It's really nobody's fault. As a Tibetan Buddhist saying recommends, roll all blames into one. Crazy wisdom does the dance of death. In the Parinirvana Sutra, the Buddha says, of all mindfulness meditations, that on death is supreme. And Dorothy Parker says, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling? As we come to the end of this crazy wisdom story, we come to death, or else death finally comes to us. Everybody and everything dies. In some very real sense, crazy wisdom has been talking about death all along, the death of knowledge and truth, beliefs and philosophies, the death of art forms and political institutions, nations and empires, the death of gods and goddesses, even the death of planets and galaxies and universes. It is appropriate that we join crazy wisdom in this last dance. Each of us and all of our offspring will disappear from Earth. In a few billion years, the sun will explode, and with that fiery event, surely the Earth will be destroyed. The pyramids and the Eiffel Tower and the World Trade Center will be gone, and all copies of the Bible will have burned up. You may be thinking that by then, with luck, humans will have emigrated from this planet into a more stable solar system. We have to remember that according to current astronomical understanding, the entire universe is in either of two processes, expanding into nothingness or slowing down expansion, which eventually will cause it to collapse back into a single particle. Whichever occurs, not even Shakespeare will survive. What do we fear when we fear death? The loss of ourselves? According to the holy fools, there is no self. All we have to lose are our illusions. Death is simply a way of ending this painful separation, a way of dissolving back into the flow, a homecoming. Crazy wisdom says, we have nothing to fear from death, but nothing, and nothing is nothing to fear at all. Or as Jorge Luis Borges puts it, death is just infinity closing in. Perhaps the most tragic aspect of death is that we fear it so much. Recent research shows that people who are medically resuscitated aren't too happy about the revival. Apparently they enjoyed being dead. They say it's very peaceful. As Mark Twain once wrote, everyone says how hard it is that we have to die. This is a strange complaint to come from the mouths of people who have had to live. Death is crazy wisdom's best friend and most important teacher. When we get to know our own death and ask it to move in with us, all things assume their proper perspective. Rumi puts it this way, why fear grief when death walks so close beside? Don't fear the general if you are good friends with the prince. Eastern holy fools have developed many ways to become friendly with death. Most meditation practices can be understood as a rehearsal for death, an exercise in letting go of each moment. When death arrives, we might then be ready to let go of the last moment of life. Some Hindu and Buddhist yogis meditate at graveyards and cremation grounds to become intimate with the process of decay and transformation. Tibetan monks blow ceremonial horns made from human femurs and eat food out of bowls carved from human skulls. In these actions, they partake of life in the face of death, thereby becoming more intimate with both. From the perspective of life, which is the only perspective available to us, death is nothing to fear. Crazy wisdom tries to explain it this way. If life is a joke, then death is the punchline. If life is a tragedy, death means the show is over and we can leave for home. If we have many lives, as believed in the East, then we must also have many deaths, so we might as well get good at dying. Also, some sages say that only by learning how to die do we finally learn how to live. What a deal. Two lessons in one. But as usual, there's a catch. Those same sages will also tell us that once we learn how to live and die, we are finally allowed off the wheel of rebirth. In other words, just when we get it right, the game is over. Oh well. That's life. In Journey to Ixtlan, the sorcerer Don Juan tells Carlos Castaneda to keep death over his left shoulder. To do this, it helps to have an image that represents death. Some people visualize the Grim Reaper, usually with a smiling skull. You might also picture nuclear bombs, the sleek modern symbols of death. For your death and dying practice, the Pentagon has conveniently listed their nuclear weapons according to size and then given each a cute name, offering a personal touch. There are bombs called Juliet and Hotel. Our favorite is a relatively small bomb with the explosive equivalent of 50,000 tons of TNT named Golf. Whenever we get lost in pettiness and need to pause for perspective, we can then visualize the Golf bomb over our left shoulders. Four! That should clear the mind of confusion and allow us to play on through. Every form is subject to transformation. That is the law of nature. And so each of us goes from womb to world to tomb to worms, just as our species travels from waves to caves to graves, and some would say back to start again. Every ending is also a beginning, and death surely leads somewhere. We do know that without death for comparison, there would be no such thing as life. Crazy Wisdom wonders why this moment of transformation has such a poor reputation. The thought of dying evokes fear and sorrow. The very word death has become laden with negative connotations. Death. It sounds so sudden and final. Perhaps we should give it another name. This new name should refer to the transition of the spirit, the aura, the essence that we often call a person's energy. Since we usually think of the spirit in terms of light, let's look at a light metaphor. We might imagine that when we cease to exist, our light fades into the surrounding shadow, or conversely, that our shadows fade into the surrounding light. Instead of calling this transformation death, we can now call it the dissolve. It's still the big D, but to dissolve implies only that one has lost one's outline. We dissolve into that place where there is only darkness or pure eternal light. We will all dissolve someday. She is sick and dissolving. After all, that is how we leave. We just fade from sight and from memory, and the show goes on. There is a crazy wisdom tradition among poets, artists, and Zen monks in Japan to write a death poem as one approaches the final moments of life. It is considered cheating to write the death poem before one is quite sure that death is imminent, since the poem is a final test of one's attitude toward death, a testament to one's level of spiritual attainment. On their deathbeds, the masters are fearless, in full control of their artistic powers, and ready with wry perceptions of crazy wisdom. The poet Issa. From one basin to another, stuff and nonsense. The poet Sen'an. Bury me when I die beneath a wine barrel in a tavern. With luck, the cask will leak. The poet Kyoriku. Till now I thought that death befell the untalented alone. If those with talent, too, must die, surely they make a better manure. A few days before his death, Zen teacher Kozan Ichikyo called his pupils together and ordered them to bury him without ceremony, forbidding them to hold services in his memory. He wrote the following poem on the morning of his death, laid down his brush, and died sitting upright. He wrote, "Empty-handed I entered the world, barefoot I leave it. My coming, my going, two simple happenings that got entangled." It is customary and auspicious for Zen monks to die while sitting in meditation. Chinese Zen master Qixin asked his disciples, "Who dies sitting?" They answered, "A monk." Then he asked, "Who dies standing?" His disciples answered, "Enlightened monks." Qixin then took 7 steps and died standing up. In his book Oriental Humor, R.H. Blythe tells of an even more impressive exit. Zen monk Teng Yinfeng asked his followers if anyone had ever died upside down. When they told him it had never been seen or heard of, Teng stood on his head and died. A great closing act for a great fool. And finally, the end, which is also the middle. Ezra Pound writes in Canto 16, "And I am not a demigod. I cannot make it cohere." It may not be wise to draw any conclusions from what's been said in this program, but it would be crazy not to try. In any case, there are several good quotations left that might go nicely into a summary. So let's begin to conclude. As Groucho Marx might say, "Hello, I must be going." We have heard many different voices singing variations on the crazy wisdom themes, and the most common refrain is that we can't be sure about much of anything. As soon as we become too certain of our understanding, the trickster arises to switch the shape of things or reveal another layer of reality. According to crazy wisdom, truth's name is transformation. Crazy wisdom points out that everything we know, everything we believe, and everything we are is destined to evolve or dissolve into something else. Life transforms from microbe to monkey to man. Man raises a flag only to have it lowered and another one unfurled in its place. As we move from culture to culture and paradigm to paradigm, today's conventional understanding continually overturns yesterday's. Gods come and go, and new scientific and artistic movements arise to show us truth and beauty from different angles. Meanwhile, the universe continues on toward a destiny about which we can only speculate. In his book, The Universe and Dr. Einstein, Lincoln Barnett offers a current story about the end of the world. He writes, "The sun is slowly but surely burning out, the stars are dying embers, and everywhere in the cosmos heat is burning to cold, matter is dissolving into radiation, and energy is being dissipated into empty space. The universe is thus progressing toward an ultimate heat death, or, as it is technically defined, a condition of maximum entropy. When all system and order in the universe have vanished, when randomness is at its maximum and entropy cannot be increased, when there is no longer any sequence of cause and effect, in short, when the universe has run down, there will be no direction to time, there will be no time, and there is no way of avoiding this destiny." The voices of crazy wisdom caution us against imputing too much importance to ourselves or to our species. The clowns still trip over their shoelaces and their pride, while the tricksters rub off the thin veneer of our dignity and civilization to reveal the raw original design. Mark Twain punctured human pride like a master. He wrote, "Man has been here 32,000 years. That it took 100 million years to prepare the world for him is proof that that is what it was done for. I suppose it is. I don't know. If the Eiffel Tower were now representing the world's age, the skin of paint on the pinnacle knob at its summit would represent man's share of that age, and anybody would perceive that that skin was what the tower was built for. I reckon they would. I don't know." Many of the voices of crazy wisdom have told us that what we call reason is not that reasonable at all. Holy fools have explained their suspicion of the rational mind and tried to disabuse us of our persistent urge to categorize and analyze. While psychologists and biochemists find that the mind is deeply conditioned, even mechanistic in its functioning. Some holy fools insist that the most truly reasonable faculty, what we might call consciousness, has not yet developed in us. Indeed, we only have to look at history for proof of how unreasonable our species can be in the name of reason. The very existence of crazy wisdom implies that another kind of intelligence might arise once we accept our ignorance and our limitations, A better balance of doing and being may be possible in our lives. It is likely that we do not yet understand how to understand. Or, as Jean-Paul Sartre once said, everything has been figured out except how to live. Life itself seems to be a paradox, both meaningful and meaningless, important and insignificant, a joke and a yoke. These mutually exclusive qualities exist simultaneously, just as wave and particle do in the subatomic world. For all practical purposes, life is many things at once. Poet Robert Frost captures this understanding with a line he wanted engraved on his tombstone. I had a lover's quarrel with the world. If there is a lesson to be drawn from the Crazy Wisdom story, it might be that it is time to slow down and relax, to learn less of doing and more of being. Given the brevity of our existence and the fact that we don't know what it means or what we are supposed to be doing, perhaps our only recourse is to learn how to be in the moment with what is given. This sentiment has been expressed in different ways by many sages, most often in the simplest of terms. As Meher Baba said, "Don't worry, be happy." As Alfred E. Newman said, "What, me worry?" These few words may sound too simplistic to those for whom reality implies difficulty and complexity. Nonetheless, many holy fools have emphasized simplicity of thought and living as the path to harmony, and therefore the ultimate human virtue. Some modern crazy wisdom masters tell us that slowing down may actually be progress, and that just sitting still may be one of the most useful of all activities. To elaborate on these sentiments and close this program, we leave you with the statement of the poet Pablo Neruda, offering us the final words of crazy wisdom. Keeping quiet. Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still, for once on the face of the earth. Let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for a second, and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment, without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would not look at his hurt hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems to be dead in winter and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go.